Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I am your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Arrrr!
That was a nice one. Today is April 13th, 2013, and this is episode 25, a GameBuoy spotlight on BioShock Infinite. So, those of you who have been with us from our ever so humble beginnings, what? We're humble, I promise. You might recall that our very first episode of GameBuoy, all those year ago, was devoted solely to discussion of Mass Effect 3. Well, it seems an appropriate way to begin GameBuoy Year 2 by focusing on another game that we have a lot to say about. I'm talking about BioShock Infinite, of course. So, we're not on a spoiler alert yet, but we will be once we get to the discussion topic. If you're spoiler averse, don't worry, you will get a second chance to turn us off before we dig into the meat of what we're quite sure is going to be a major contender for Game of the Year this year. Yes, it could also be considered super ironic that we're doing another spotlight episode on a super major AAA game, but I promise the next one will be indie slash left of center as shit, so deal with it.
Can we do a spotlight on Eggmania?
I want to say no, but I also feel like that would be the only way to top doing a podcast on Tingle.
Ah!
So, for the moment, though, let's sort of get things going, and let's take a look at our follow-ups. Slagkick, if you'd like to take this first one.
Killer is Dead put out a second trailer, and it's awesome and crazy. There's a lady who has, like, 16 arms, and they're all holding guns. Crazy aliens. Very crazy craziness, as you would expect from Suda Goichi.
So you're telling me that Grasshopper Manufacturer and Suda Goichi are basically just being batshit crazy in a cool cel-shaded style.
Yes. And, I mean, the thing that I noticed is that, you know, it seems like this one is going to be a very ambitious title. It looks like the way that they're presenting the trailers are very cinematic. And so I'm very excited to see how the storytelling is.
Yeah, I really, watching this current trailer, most particularly, in fact, it really seemed like a marriage of sort of the narrative style of Killer 7 and the sort of presentation, of course, of like a No More Heroes style action-y game.
Right, and I mean, something that I noticed is that the trailers, and I don't know if he's done this before with other trailers, but it seems very much like an anime, like, next time. Like, so, like, they do the little character spotlights, and I know, like, obviously Team Fortress did, like, Meet the Heavy and stuff, but it's not the same. It just seemed, like, made me think of, like, the Evangelion trailers where they're like, and there'll be plenty of fan service, hee-hee.
I do think that that's kind of intentional on their part. I feel like we might have seen things like that for No More Heroes, but I can't really recall. That was a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Next up, we have Shin Megami Tensei 4 having been announced for release in the U.S. That'll be coming out this summer. Last I heard, Amazon had it up for July 17th, I think. So that's very exciting.
Year of Shin Megami Tensei.
Seriously, year of Luigi, I tell you.
It's more like a Year of Atlas, I would say, would be the more accurate.
Indeed. One thing I also kind of wanted to talk about very briefly about Shin Megaten 4 is that it's going to be retailing here in the U.S. at a $50 price point.
$50? That's a lot of money.
$50!
$50!
$50!
Why is it $50, though? Like, seriously.
Because my understanding, at least, and we need to appreciate that, as far as I know, there hasn't been any specific public statement on this yet. But the most common speculation seems to be regarding the fact that it's coming out only 2 months after release in Japan. In fact, less than 2 months. And Index, the parent company of Atlus, has, with regard to some of the Persona anime, for example, made concessions, also other Persona titles, so, you know, the same family of games, They've made a lot of concessions to try and fight, like, reverse importing. So my understanding is that it's priced higher here because we're getting it while it's still going to be sort of valuable in the overseas marketplace to sort of deter reverse importation.
Interesting. I mean, I'm sure it'll be definitely worth every penny, but I won't be surprised if we hear a lot of price QQ about this.
It's definitely, definitely going to be a Kotaku article on $50, $50, $50, $50.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but for DS, 3DS, this is kind of unprecedented price point.
The only other game I can think of that was launching at this price point was Resident Evil Revelations, back when they were talking about how it had a console title level amount of budgeting. And even then they cracked and it did not really launch at that in any real meaningful way. In fact, you also can look at some Vita titles, Uncharted, for example, which was launching at that point and then quickly price dropped to a more standard handheld price point of $40.
So do you think that we will still see this price point before release?
I believe it will launch at this price point, especially if it is a tactic to fight reverse importation, such as when Index only allowed the U.S. licensor of the Persona anime to do an English dub track and not include a Japanese language track on the Blu-ray release.
Yikes.
So that, of course, Japanese people wouldn't reverse import the Blu-rays here, where they're much cheaper. If that is the tactic, I do think we'll see it launch at $50 and probably price drop, you know, a month or two down the line.
You know, I think my concern is just that people will be turned off, and I would hate to see them not sell to their expectations because of that price point. But, you know, I'm sure this will probably be a good jumping in point for the series, because I think a lot of people are a lot more aware of the series, I mean, the whole family of games, because of the popularity of Persona, as we've talked about.
Now, I have a comment to make to you directly right now, and also to everyone out there listening in Radioland. If you're the kind of person who has complained about Japanese titles not coming to the U.S. quickly, this is your time to prove to Japanese publishers that, and people who license games from Japanese publishers, this is your time to show them whether or not you're willing to pay an extra $10 to have a game a month and a half after it comes out in Japan. Now, if you're not willing to do that, of course do not. Like, that's fine. But for anyone who complained that, you know, a few months later, not the Japanese release of Bravely Default Flying Fairy is unacceptable and we should know if it's coming out here by now, this is your time to really speak up and say that there's a market for these games. We're willing to pay a little bit more if we have to. Just get us this content and get it quick. So don't buy it if you're not into it. If you have an issue with supporting a price range in this for these niche titles, by all means, do pass it up. Don't buy stuff you don't want and don't support business practices you don't support. But
just realize what the repercussions
are. Realize that the repercussion is sending a signal that this is not a profitable way to conduct business and that there will be negative consequences to that, such as showing them that it's not profitable to bring these games over quick like this.
So you can't complain about high price points for games coming over quickly, but then also complain about games not being announced quickly. Well, I mean, you can, but we're just going to kind of judge you.
Yeah, the most obvious way to fight this trend is to buy a game if you want it and push that message that this is something that you should be bringing over. This is your opportunity. I'm going to do my part, and I'm definitely going to buy a copy.
Another game in which gamers can speak with their wallets. A Game Buoy title we've been following for a while, Project Cross Zone, is dated officially for a June 25th North American release.
Yes, 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 yes. I am so excited about this.
This, of course, is the title that brings together over 200 characters from Namco, Capcom, and Sega. And, my understanding is the Japanese audio track, which, I mean, is not really a big deal.
You know, interestingly, there was a pre-launch trailer with the English dialogue.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it just went up yesterday or the day before.
So maybe things have changed in that regard.
It's in English, but with no voices. However, the publisher has confirmed it will have Japanese language voices when it releases here.
See, my understanding last I was reading up on it was that it was going to be Japanese only.
It's going to be Japanese voices only with English text translation.
Okay. Which, I mean, that doesn't bother me.
I'm perfectly fine with
that. I love listening to Japanese people talk.
Which is ironic, considering how badly you butcher everything Japanese.
Sorry, Japanese people.
Also on the menu today, Batman Arkham Origins has been revealed on a Game Informer cover.
Oh, Game Informer.
Oh, you. And that's going to be out in October. And that's exciting, of course, because I love these big-budget 3D Metroidvania-style games. But more importantly, there's going to be a 2.5D Metroidvania game for 3DS and Vita, like as a tie-in. So I'm definitely very here for that.
Now, I have to ask you, apparently the handheld companion game will be developed by Armature Studios. I'm not familiar with their output. Are you?
They actually don't have any yet. They were founded by leads from the Metroid Prime series who left Retro Studios a while back.
Oh, wow. Okay. So a good crew of people.
Yeah. In fact, with this announcement, there was a really funny, I don't know if it was a leak or if they released these assets, but they basically revealed and discussed a little bit that they were working on a Mega Man X first-person shooter reboot. Normally, I'm like, really?
But it's Mega Man X.
But you know what? That was my response when these very same people rebooted Metroid as a first-person shooter, and Metroid Prime, I think, is an incredible game. So, and, you know, they didn't stop making 2D Metroids at the same time as they started making Metroid Primes, so... You know, if...
Hey, it would have been a Mega Man game.
Exactly.
More than Capcom's doing in-house.
It wouldn't have precluded the existence of other Mega Man games. I would have liked to have seen Mega Man anything. I would freaking take that awful iOS game at this point.
Wait, did that get canceled too?
No, that came out, I think. Awful.
Yeah. Wait, you're talking about the one that's like... That is Mega Man X, but it's like... Super butchered and... Not good.
No, there was a Mega Man crossover style game.
Oh, yeah, we talked about that on Game
Yes,
Movie.
We Oops. Did.
Sorry, I forgot about that.
God,
probably
you're
because
so dumb.
Probably because it was so horrible, right? That's why I forgot about
You're not really dumb. It was awful. That's probably why you forgot about it. You blocked it out mentally.
Well, you're being such a smart class right now.
Smart
class. Sorry, that was the worst transition ever. Smart class.
More like the best.
For Android... is getting some updates. It will support 7-inch tablets, larger tablets, and it will have always-on support, which does not mean like the always-on drama that we've been hearing about. Deal with it. It just means that if you're using Smart Glass, that it won't go into sleep mode. And there are also numerous bug fixes, so good for people who have Androids. Yeah. It's interesting that there's no word on iOS or like Microsoft Surface?
I guess I would be more interested in that information with regard to iOS, getting some of these bug fixes, if I liked Smart Glass more.
Yeah, I kind of find it hard to care about Smart
Glass. It's kind of half-baked.
It was cool when we played Karaoke Channel that one time.
Yeah, except when it would bug out.
Oh, well, maybe they bug fixed it for Android.
Yeah. In a bit of non-typical Game Buoy news, WayForward has confirmed their new project, and it is a movie tie-in to the live-action Smurfs movie.
Smurfs 2.
Smurfs
that,
2.
That shit got a sequel.
That hurts me.
Thanks, Hollywood. So all I have to say about this is, what the Smurf?
Well, you know what? It's way forward. It's almost guaranteed to be a good game. Almost.
Yeah, honestly, even with Smurfs 2, if anyone could pull it off, it'll be way forward.
Yeah. I'm really excited.
It'll be a big year for WayForward.
It is. It is. And, you know, I watched the little trailer that was on Joystick, and it looks like a cute little platformer with some cool, like, ability-based problem-solving. Not quite puzzles, but just, like, problem-solving. And I'm actually kind of excited. I mean, I think it looks kind of dumb, but it might also make up.
It might make up for the fact that those types of movies kick us right into childhood.
Yeah. No. Totally.
Like remember the Alvin and the Chipmunks movie?
Hey, a good game with a shitty license is still a good game.
Yeah. So maybe we can just pretend it's just a Smurfs game.
I'm just gonna pretend it's a Shantae game.
Hopefully Shantae and the Pirate's Curse will come out soon.
Oh, fingers crossed. Next up, we have actually some really exciting news.
Really good news.
You probably recall...
some legendary news.
Stop. You might recall over the last few weeks, we've been kind of QQing a lot about the Rayman Legends delay for Wii U.
It's not just us, people at Ubisoft themselves.
It's true. But senior game manager of Rayman Legends, Michael Mikolic, said in an interview that they are adding some rather major content to this game. And that is major to the tune of 30 new levels and several new major boss fights.
Say what?
Yeah.
That's great, though. I mean, you know, honestly, they could have just been, like, begrudgingly porting it to the other consoles or whatever. But, you know, I'm glad that they took something that sucked and turned it into something that they'll be proud of.
Lemonade out of lemons. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of speculation on the internet that some of these 30 new levels may be because the 360 and PS3 versions of Rayman Legends will need new levels designed that don't use the touchscreen pal Murphy. So since they're making new stages for those games, of course, they're also porting them to Wii U. I don't really know what I think about that, except more good content is more good content, and I at least appreciate that they're not sitting on the game for the next 6 months.
I'd kind of love it if those levels shipped with the Wii U version, but then they were DLC for the other consoles.
That would please me, but it seems very unlikely.
Yeah.
Frankly, the way Wii U owners keep getting screwed over, I'd almost expect them to be DLC on the Wii U version. Yeah, they have a tendency to pee on one's leg and tell you that it's raining. It's all very sad.
Nice Judge Judy reference.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Don't you remember that her autobiography was called "Don't Pee on My Leg and Tell Me That It's Raining"? You didn't know that?
I didn't know that because that's an axiom that's been used for basically forever.
See, I thought you were just...
like, that's like a real...
No,
like...
I know that, but I thought you were specifically referring to Judge Judy because she's a boss bitch. You can't argue with that, can you?
So Ace Attorney 5 is due out on July 25th in Japan.
Speaking of the courtroom...
No, let it go!
I would love to play Judge Judy Ace Attorney.
I hate you, Gooby.
Dolan, please.
All right. This has gone off track.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't this announced as the final Ace Attorney for the foreseeable future? Wasn't this supposed to be like the concluding chapter of Ace's story?
I feel like I had heard
that. I'm sorry,
that.
Not Ace's. Phoenix Wright's, sorry. I sound like one of those, like, moms who, like, would be like, oh, look, it's Pokemon! And, like, is referring to Pikachu. Isn't that Pokemon? I'm like, oh, look, there's Ace Attorney. Sorry.
You're quite right. This is like a brief, like a shining moment of self-realization for you, isn't it?
I feel so embarrassed and ashamed.
Like, I feel like I need Pen on the side. Everyone's congratulating you. He's just like, whack!
I feel like I've brought dishonor and shame unto the SS Game Buoy.
That's because you have. Anyway, moving on. It's time for
news. Oh my God, news. So we may have thought that Tinglecast was the best April Fool's Day joke ever, but I think Guild Wars 2 has topped us.
Ooh.
You nasty girl.
Continue.
So originally they had planned to do a little fake 8-bit update, but this project called Super Adventure Box grew into a 16-bit Wonderland that's fully playable for the month of April in Guild Wars 2.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's a little 3D pixel world inspired by some of our classic favorites from the NES. And there's like in-game lore. I don't really know the in-game lore for Guild Wars because I didn't play too much of it, honestly, after it came out. But apparently there's an inventor named Moto, as in Shigeru Miyamoto. And you can enter the Super Adventure Box in the capital of Ratasum. I guess that's how you say it. I don't know how to say Guild Wars names. And it looks super cute. Like, I kind of wish that that's what Guild Wars looked like all the time.
Yeah, you know, I just looking at this, these images, watching the little commercial that they did for it. I have to say, I'm really, like, I literally have now updated my Guild Wars 2 to get back into it just to play this content. It looks really, really, really cute and really cool.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer that it will only be running throughout April. I mean, I guess if like people like really are really like if there's a really positive response to it, maybe they'll find a way to keep it accessible.
Yeah, I have to assume. And further, you know, maybe they'll do another really cool one for next year. That would be also cool.
I guess just looking at these screenshots and everything and the little trailer just made me realize that I would totally play an 8-bit style MMO.
Yeah, I would play an 8-bit just about anything. Let's be real.
Speaking of retro-looking stuff, the DLC for Far Cry...
It's exciting.
The DLC for Far Cry 3 called Blood Dragon. Oh, gosh.
Yeah,
I haven't even been drinking any rum today, people, and I'm just sloppy.
That's cray.
They put out a VHS-style trailer. You know, it even has, like, the fake, like, tape wear, whatever.
Scan lines and stuff.
Scan lines, thank you. I mean, I only assume that that's not actually what the DLC looks like, but I wish it did.
You know, based on the images that have been released so far, I almost kind of feel like maybe it does look something like that. Like, it looks pretty, like, all of the screenshots I've seen look pretty darn ridiculous.
Yeah, if that's the case, I might have to play Far Cry 3, because I am here for retro, vintage throwbacks. I am honestly, like, shamelessly always down for that.
Yeah, and I also want to point out, and of course we'll link this on GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
But please don't do that. There is a official site for Blood Dragon that basically looks like my old Tingle website. It's pretty much incredible.
By the way, if you haven't visited Great Fairy Spike's Tiny Tingle Town, go to the Tinglecast page. We link to it from there. I have to applaud Great Fairy Spike, Captain Spike, for his wonderful web development skills.
I can't even right now. Like, this is too much for me.
Nintendo, in an effort to try and sell more eShop prepaid cards, will be bundling them with AR cards, and they look really cute.
In Japan.
In Japan, yeah. And, like, the 1,000 yen card has a Goomba, 2,000 yen has Super Mario, and 3,000 yen has Princess Peach. And they can interact with each other. So if you have the Mario card and the Goomba card out, Mario will stomp on the Goomba.
Hell yeah.
Super cute. I feel like we haven't even really touched, well, not we, but, you know, the gaming community in general has not even really started to scratch the surface of what could be done with AR.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's
really
true.
It's really exciting to see see possibly the roots of the future of gaming here.
Yep.
And prepaid cards. Who knew?
Next up, of course, information and photos on this actually leaked before our last episode. So you've probably heard about this by now. But we didn't want to report on it until it was absolutely confirmed. Poker Night at the Inventory 2 is definitely a really real thing. And it is, of course, as a sequel to Poker Night 1, going to involve playing poker with well-known game characters.
Poker Night, Poker Night.
Oh, girl. The guest cameos this time around, however, include Claptrap from Borderlands, Sam from Sam and Max, Brock Samson from Venture Brothers, which is exciting as shit.
Right?
Ash from freaking Evil Dead / Army of Darkness, and GLaDOS from the Portal game.
She's gonna be the dealer.
That's incredible. I cannot wait.
Yeah, that looks super silly.
Also, something that is new and exciting that has been announced by Capcom. They're starting a new multimedia franchise. It's going to be an anime, collectible toys, manga, and primarily a 3DS game called Geist Crusher.
Based on MD Geist? Most Dangerous Geist?
No, not based on MD Geist at all. That would be awful.
Thank God.
However, the game appears to be sort of a shonen-style Monster Hunter game.
Here for taking, that.
Taking, you know, sort of design cues from the Mega Man series. And so basically, I'm just asking where I can inject this straight into my bloodstream, because I need an IV of Geist Crusher stat.
And I'm seeing a lot of buzz that is not only looking like there will be Mega Man elements, but specifically Mega Man Legends. Which, I mean, I guess makes sense when you think of that.
Oh, it being 3D and stuff, yeah. Yeah, I definitely think it looks very exciting. The trailer looked good to me. I'm here for this, and I just hope it comes to the U.S.
Best of luck to Capcom with this new IP.
Absolutely. And a bit of sad news for me. Despite having a small but devoted fan base, Dungeon Fighter Online will be ending its North America support due to an overall lack of players.
Aw, I remember when that came out, you were really into it.
Yeah, well, you know, I was really, really excited for this game when it was first coming out in Japan as Arad Senki. And there was, multimedia stuff, and I consumed all of it. I was definitely super here for this. I loved its art design. I loved the fact that it plays like an MMO version of the Mystara Capcom Dungeons & Dragons games.
Which will be coming soon to Xbox Live Arcade and other versions of stuff.
So, yeah, I'm really bummed to hear this. It's one of the few free-to-play games where I've actually spent a fairly decent amount of money in the cash shop. Just for, extra costumes for my fighter.
Which is not something that you're usually here
no,
for.
No, that is not something I'm usually here for. But I just liked this game so much.
I have to confess, I'm one of the people who played it for a while and then just kind of forgot about it. So I guess I'm part of the problem, not the solution.
And more sad news, and honestly probably way sadder for the vast majority of you out there. Actually, when I think about it from this respect, it's really sad to me, too. Disney shut down LucasArts.
Yeah. Big news that you've probably heard of, but how can we not talk about it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the first thing and sort of what I was thinking of when I first was leading into this topic, of course, was the sort of current-ish, I guess no longer current, but formerly current Star Wars games, 1313... and Star Wars First Assault, which was theoretically going to be a continuation of, the Battlefront games. Oh, pardon. And, I mean, that's sad, but at the same time, I'm not really here for an open-world Boba Fett simulator. That's not really my bag, so...
The thing is that the last game they put out was Kinect Star Wars, which was a big stinker.
Yeah, that was it. Just
apparently
was awful.
Apparently there's something like a Han Solo rap. I don't know because I can't bring myself to watch that on YouTube or anything. But I mean, and you think about the talent that
I have a copy if you want to play it.
How much alcohol is involved?
We'd need a lot. Otherwise, it's not a good thing.
Yikes. I mean, you think about LucasArts, and it's mostly sad because you think about Maniac Mansion and Secret of Monkey Island.
Grim Fandango!
And, like, you know, Ron Gilbert, Tim Schafer. You know, Ron Gilbert, who, of course, just parted ways with Double Fine to tread his own territory with...
Yes, as we talked about last week. Yes.
But, I mean, the thing is, the last thing that they really put out that people were kind of into was The Force Unleashed. And even then, I mean, honestly...
I actually thought The Force Unleashed was a super, super good game, and it really sucked that The Force Unleashed 2 was awful.
Honestly, it's sad news, but mostly sad for employees losing their jobs. Mostly.
Yeah, especially when you consider, you know, like the Tales from Monkey Island game not that long ago. That was actually developed by Telltale and just licensed via LucasArts. So, you know, certainly it sucks that LucasArts is closing. I'm really, 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 really sad.
Was that necessary?
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about LucasArts. But at the same time, their output of late has simply not been where it's needed to be for a long time. I'm sorry, I still remember how awful Thrillville was, and that was them.
Oh, that's right. That was a big letdown.
Yeah.
Although, do you know what I liked about Thrillville?
What's
that? Is that, like, it had a soundtrack of, like, 5 songs or something, and one of them was Suddenly I See by KT Tunstall.
Okay, I am always here for that song, though, so...
So that was, like, the only reason I liked Thrillville was because it had Suddenly I See. Suddenly I See!
So, in further sad news, Sega Studios Australia has been confirmed to be closing its doors permanently later this year.
Wow, just more closures. Sad.
Yeah, I mean... admittedly, Sega Studios Australia primarily existed these days just to work on Olympics games. London 2012 Olympics.
Honestly, if I wanted to play an Olympics game, which I probably wouldn't...
I play track and field on the NES.
Well, yeah, but I mean, barring that, I'd rather go for Mario and Sonic at the Olympics than an Olympics.
Yeah. Well, it might have just been redundant. Yeah. I don't think these guys were doing the Sonic and Mario at the Olympics games.
No, it's just saying London 2012, so, yeah.
My point being that Sega is still making the money on the Olympics games that people actually do want, so this might have just been a simple case of redundancy, unfortunately.
Pretty much.
Our hearts and thoughts go out to these people who worked for Sega Studios
Australia.
Especially
because Australians are sexy.
They're hella sexy. But at the same time...
New Zealanders are sexier.
Yeah. I can think of a couple New Zealanders that are super hot.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, though, getting off track. Super sad that this studio is closing, and we here at Game Buoy hope that all of those people can quickly find new and high-quality employment.
Definitely.
In yet another really, really just sad piece of news, High Moon Studios laid off 40 people from the Deadpool team. You might be familiar with High Moon Studios, both from the upcoming Deadpool game, as well as the fairly good Cybertron series Transformers games over the last few years. I don't know what's going on over there. I know that, you know, these guys are working with Activision. They're an Activision studio, and just 40 people full-time laid off. Like, that's crazy to me. So, I really hope that these guys are also treated well by the job market and can find new work at other studios quickly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's so sad to think about the human element behind it all. It's like, you know, you can think about the... like business logistics or whatever, and like, okay, yeah, they've had their reasons, but you know, anytime these creative people are being let go, and you know, these people have families and lives, and you know, these games do not exist in a void, which I think a lot of people sometimes forget, that there are real living, breathing people putting their heart and soul into these games. Yeah,
it's really sad, and unfortunately, also sad is that Square Enix Los Angeles has had a number of positions eliminated and will be laying off the majority of their staff. In addition to their CEO of Square Enix America, you know, being sort of out the door in May. So that's just further just really sad news. And, you know, Square Enix, we talked a little bit last
with
week. With Wada-san on his way out.
I mean, a lot
things
of change.
Are just a big
lot of
mess
change
over there.
For Square Enix. In news that is not sad, at least probably not for most people, Aliens Colonial Marines for Wii U is no longer in development.
Now, it's interesting that they use the term development when I feel like they had previously confirmed that the game was basically done. But, you know, at this point, the game was a mess on every platform it was released on. I don't think I know a single person who was happy with this game. I'm not, this is the one time that Wii U owners are, like, lucky for not getting a game.
Yeah.
If you had a pre-order in for this, I did at one point. After all the bad reviews hit, I canceled it, but, I just, it's hard for me to be upset about this because the
game
looks awful.
That game might have almost been as poorly reviewed as the movie The Host, based on Stephenie Meyer's book The Host.
Yeah, I hope most of our listeners don't really know what that is. in super cheery news,
yes.
Have we talked about Shovel Knight on the air?
I don't think we have.
Shovel Knight is a retro style NES style game on that's being kickstarted that takes inspiration by games such as Mega Man and Castlevania. I recommend you Google Shovel Knight, and that's like a knight with a sword, not a knight with like stars and stuff. Anyway, in the spirit of games such as Mega Man and Castlevania, the folks that are working on Shovel Knight, are Yacht Club Games, and they have contacted and contracted Manami Matsume, who composed music for games such as the original Mega Man, UN Squadron, and Mega Man 10, to do music for Shovel Knight.
That's great.
Now, she will not be doing all of the music for Shovel Knight, but she is going to be doing two themes for the game.
That's super cool.
Most of the music is going to be done by Jake Vert Kaufman, whom, if you're into the sort of chiptune scene, you know who I'm talking about right now. So this is just very exciting. This is a very exciting development to have Matsume-san involved in this. So I'm really excited for this game. I really recommend you look into it. I try not to really pitch Kickstarters to you guys every week because a lot of people have problems with them, and we've talked about it on the show. I'm not going to get into it again, but again, Shovel Knight looks great. Super excited about the music. You want to take this next one?
Sure. Another World 20th Anniversary Edition is, now available on Steam. And it is a 20th Anniversary Edition. It's already available on iOS, Android, BlackBerry 10. BlackBerry 10? Who still has a BlackBerry? So, you know, if you are here for that, go get it right now. I honestly was not too familiar with it before reading up on it, but, it looks really cool.
Have you never played the original?
No, I didn't.
You know, it was released in the U.S. as Out of This World.
Oh, I remember hearing about that game a lot, and I was disappointed because it wasn't about the girl on the TV show named Evie, who could freeze time by touching her fingers together. But I that's probably why I didn't make the connection. But I remember. That's why there was
a star.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about this. You know, it also like had a pseudo sequel in a game called Flashback. which was also an incredible game. I'm really excited about this.
Now, I feel like, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like I had been reading about this somewhere else, and it's been, like, redone kind of with new art assets, right?
Ish.
I might have been reading about something else. I apologize.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It looks redone in new assets. It's just they appear to emulate the original pretty closely, as you would want. The game already was so super stylized, especially in a time where sort of that level of stylization in graphical representation in games was not super common. You didn't see things that were quite so distinctly, intentionally very stylized.
Sorry to backtrack for a moment, but you had brought up Jake Vert Kaufman.
Uh-huh.
I forgot he is also doing the music for DuckTales Remastered.
Yeah, he does a lot of work with WayForward.
Well, yeah, he's WayForward's guy. He did Shantae Risky's Revenge. And, I think he did original Shantae, right?
Probably. He's been working with WayForward for a long time.
Yeah. So Shantae, he stays.
Oh, girl. Moving on. Torchlight, you might recall. Torchlight 2... Runic Games, the developers thereof, have released a consumer version of the internal development tool set it used to build Torchlight 2. This is the Guts suite of game tools.
Which makes me think of Nickelodeon Guts.
Nickelodeon Guts! Man, we are just off topic as heck today. And this suite of tools allows the user to edit everything, like from your items and like straight up like level, like maps and stuff. Do like custom quests, create all like original animations for characters and NPCs and stuff. And mods created using the Guts toolset will be able to be shared online and even support multiplayer sessions.
Nice.
They're going to be doing patching in a specific mod games, lobby for online like matchmaking for, you know, oh, I want to find people who are playing this mod. So this is really, to me, super exciting. I think this is really cool. For those of you that are playing Torchlight 2 on Steam, it will have full workshop integration so that you can just get your mod straight off of Steam.
I mean, that's worked really well for the whole modding thing in general has worked really well for Team Fortress 2. I mean, there's a lot of passion for creating content. So maybe we'll have to make a little Game Buoy stage. I don't know how to do it, but... Maybe someone who's clever enough can make a Game Buoy level in Torchlight. A little SS Game Buoy.
Maybe. Maybe I'll try to do that. Not that I have any real skill at anything. In other super, 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 super exciting news, Farewell Umihara Kawase is planned for overseas release, including here in North America. I'm really excited about this. A little known fact, one of my very favorite subgenres of games of all time are probably... like grappling hook platformers. And I generally think the Umihara Kawase series are some of the best. You know, they're rather than just straight up being a sort of Bionic Commando clone. You have your grappling hook, which has almost like a tensile, like a give and pull to it as if it was made of like a rubber band. So physics come into play in making your jumps and finding the right angle to use to sort of get more spring into your jump to do some of the more trickier platforming. I'm just a big fan, and as far as I'm aware, this is the first time that this series is coming to these shores for release. According to Silicon Era, we may well be hearing more about this during E3.
That's exciting news.
Yeah, very exciting.
Do you know what else I'm super excited about?
What are you super excited about?
So Sega put out a teaser trailer. It didn't have any, like, title information, but some people did notice there's a little copyright Disney on the bottom. It's very dark and spooky, and it has, like, some toy soldiers. Oh, maybe this is Castle of Illusion HD Remaster. Everyone is like,
girl!
Everyone is like, yeah, that's what it is. It's, like, obviously what it is.
Yeah.
Which is great news, given how... Epic Mickey Power of Illusion? No. What was that? Epic Mickey Dung Heap of Illusion.
Girl, you're better than that.
That 3DS title that just came out.
No, I know what you're talking about. I was just, yeah. You used the word dung.
No, I know. I was making fun of Kotaku. Anyway, you know, after we had been hopeful for that because of the fond memories we had for the Illusion series, which, of course, were by Sega Shinobi team for the Genesis or Mega Drive, depending on where you're at. So it's good to see that since that let us down so much, well, me personally, and probably a lot of other people, that, you know, this is great news. And, I mean, it comes right on the heels of DuckTales Remastered. So, you know, the trailer looks great. We'll link it to you on GameBuoy.org. And looking forward to that. It's summer 2013 is what it teases at the end, and it's presumably a launch window.
So what do you think about the term free to drift?
It makes me think of the Fast and the Furious.
Well, this is the actual term.
Tokyo Drift.
This is the actual term being used by Namco Bandai in promoting their upcoming Ridge Racer Driftopia.
Ridge Racer! Driftopia. which is a free-to-drift title.
It is a free-to-drift title. It's developed by the people who did Ridge Racer Unbounded, which is Bugbear Entertainment.
Aw. It sounds cute.
And it looks like it's going to be available for the PS3 and PC. Interestingly, I don't see 360 listed there, and Microsoft has previously discussed being open to free-to-play titles, having infrastructure ready for that sort of game. So I guess we'll see what the future holds for this one.
Yeah. Are you going to engage in the free-to-drift gameplay model?
I will definitely engage in the free. I might not drift.
Okay. I might drift, but not for free.
Oh, so you're just gonna buy in and have all kinds of upgrades for your cars and trick it out, but never race it?
No, I'm gonna pay and drift. I don't know where that was going. Unfortunately, in sadder news that kind of ties into what we were talking about a few minutes ago,
yeah.
EA is being hit with layoffs, but EA is not specifying which particular teams have been impacted.
Yeah, we do know that there was a closure at EA Mobile Montreal, and of course we've talked about John Riticello's resignation last month. So it just looks like things are not going super well for EA right now. You know, they got the whole worst company in the U.S. award just a couple weeks ago. And I say weeks ago, but I feel like that was maybe like a week, right? Like, it's been a long week for me.
Yeah, you know, this news just hit a couple days ago. And I guess, actually, since we first looked at this story while planning this episode, Joystick has brought some updates. Apparently, EA Mobile Brazil will be shut down by the end of the week, which means they're probably shut down.
Oh, wow, yeah.
BioWare Social, a studio in London, and the customer service center in Galway, Ireland.
Oh, boo. Well, that really sucks. As always, we here at GameBuoy, we really feel for all of you folks, and our fingers are crossed for your well-being. Some other...
See, now...
I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I'm sorry, were you about to add on before we move on to our next story?
No, I was going to move on to our next story. So.
Because, see, if you don't mind me jumping in, this is what I was reading about that had the graphical makeover. That's why I was getting mixed up.
What are you talking about?
Flashback gets a do-over on Xbox Live Arcade and PlayStation Network. So, see, that's why I was getting confused, because that was also over 20 years. Well...
Okay, so Flashback is the game that I was just talking about having been a pseudo-sequel slash follow-up to Out of This World slash Another World.
Oh, really? So they're related?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting that they're both getting...
Again, they're not connected in storyline, but they were made by, you know, mostly the same people, and when you play them back-to-back, like, they're clearly using the same super stylized art and stuff.
Now, see, this is saying that it was developed by Delphine Software... over 20 years ago, which would put it before Out of This World?
Out of This World was first. This is a phrasing issue.
Okay.
Girl. So anyway, this is very exciting to me. I'm a little less excited for Flashback than I am for Out of This World 20th Anniversary Edition. It just occurred to me because the 20th Anniversary Edition actually for Out of This World came out a couple of years ago, and it's only now available on Steam.
Oh, that's right. Duh. We should learn to read our stories better.
I was not confused. You were. I was sitting here like, what the hell are you going on about? And now I understand.
I think it was like Judge Judy and stuff.
Ah, you're awful.
You're awful.
No shit, I've met me. So, Flashback, great game. As opposed to Another World / Out of This World, where they're just doing, like, redoing the graphics and resampling them and having them look super pretty in HD or whatever. I don't know the technical terms, I just say super pretty. This is getting like a complete graphical overhaul, and that's the tip that you were on earlier.
Yes, that's why I was mixed up.
And you know, I have to say, I do think Flashback was incredible for more than just its stylized graphics. I thought it was a really cool setting. I thought it had a really cool gameplay concept or two. But I have to be honest, that super stylized graphics, it did add to how special it was at the time. So I'm somewhat trepidatious
about... Because it's
about...
just Unreal Engine, and from what we saw in the trailer, it kind of looks, not as stylized as...
Yeah, it doesn't look nearly as stylized. So, I mean, I'm still excited. I love the game. I love the way it plays. I love the way it presents its world. But as opposed to Another World, which is, like, just heartily recommend, like, yes, you should definitely go for this. Flashback is a little bit more of a wait-and-see preposition to me.
In super exciting and adorable news, the RPG Mystic Chronicles will be taking the jump from iOS to PSP this summer.
Oh, yay!
It's a cute little game, turn-based. You get little AI guardian beasts. It's going to be available on PSP, which is an interesting choice, but, I mean, I guess it makes sense. No word yet on whether that's going to be a download on Vita. Hopefully so.
Yeah, I would assume so. But I guess assuming is not necessarily safe lately.
Yeah, it's going to be localized by Natsume.
Oh, awesome.
And if you are a diehard JRPG fanatic, you might be familiar with this under the title Fantasy Chronicles, which is what it was known as on iOS.
Oh, cool. Okay, I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, it looks really cute and very retro SNES kind of looking.
Yeah.
Visual appeal.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting really excited to talk about our discussion topic. So I have three more quick news stories that I want to get to. First off, we have Anarchy Reigns getting a digital release in the US on PSN.
Great news.
And further from that, Bayonetta and the other pre-order DLCs will be available for 99 cents each.
We suggest that if, like, the levels, the extra levels are not really
multiplayer
levels, but
modes.
Multiplayer modes are available separately. Do not buy Dogfight. It was
do
selected.
Not buy Dogfight. Like, you tried.
Please
that's
do
cute.
Buy Bayo.
But, oh, yeah, no, buy Bayo. Like, even buy if Bayo. You don't. Even if you don't have Anarchy Reigns, buy Bayo.
Yeah, just buy Bayonetta for 99 cents.
You won't be able to do anything with it. But
hey, maybe they'll see that Bayonetta on PS3 is a popular thing.
Anyway, let's see. Also,
some news that was very exciting for you.
Puzzle & Dragons Z is coming to the 3DS. This is very exciting. We know very little so far. All we really know is that this is a game that's coming to the 3DS, based on the cover of an issue of Dengeki Nintendo that is going to be coming out next week.
Dengeki Nintendo!
We have a scan of the cover, and the cover says, exciting news, Puzzle & Dragons Z 3DS, see more inside. Since the magazine isn't out yet, we can't see inside, so that's where it is.
Try harder.
And, last up, there was a sort of really weird news story. You know, we've talked a lot about Rock Band over the last month or two. Rock Band on their Facebook page. And I didn't see this story run in any of the blogs. I didn't see it run anywhere. But the Rock Band Facebook page reached out to let people know that in the 5 years since the release of the first batch of Rock Band DLC, they're now starting to reach the end of some of the earlier licenses they secured for their music. They say that they're hard at work to extend these licenses to make sure that these games remain available for purchase for new people just getting into Rock Band now. But obviously, if there are older tracks in Rock Band that you would like to have and you want to make sure you have them forever, now's the time to get them.
It's mostly so like far, Metallica, right?
Well, so far, all that is coming down is the Metallica track pack. It would seem that they have had trouble relicensing that. If I had to guess, I would assume it was related to the existence of Guitar Hero Metallica now.
Right, which I assume that if anyone's really that diehard of a Metallica fan, that they probably have Guitar Hero Metallica.
But it's worth noting. And it's also worth noting that the Rock Band folks have confirmed that even for songs that they are unable to relicense, you will still be able to re-download them through your download history. So if you've already bought it, you will continue to have access to
it. Oh, good. So it'll still be on their servers then.
Yes, yes. And that is typically the way when stuff gets, you know, delisted from the services. You can still get it. It's just you can no longer buy it. So, again, so far it's just the Metallica stuff. But it sounds like we may be hearing about more of these sort of songs coming down and becoming unavailable
so
in the future.
If you're looking to expand your Rock Band library, I would suggest maybe looking at like Wikipedia's list of DLC.
Wikipedia?
You can sort it by like release date or whatever.
Oh,
or release
year. That's a good idea.
I would suggest maybe going there and seeing what came out like in the earliest couple months of Rock Band DLC and see if something catches your eye.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that was a lot of news this week.
That was a lot of news.
It's been a very busy news year so far.
It has been. 2013, man. Anyway, we're gonna sort of break from our standard format now. This is your official spoiler warning. We're going to give you a brief intermission of maybe 37 seconds, give or take. And then we will come back and we're going to bust into some BioShock discussion. That sound good to you?
Yep.
Was a pleasant little break, yeah? So, with us now, of course, here on the Good Ship SS Game Buoy, is our very first guest. Freshly landed out of a rocket from the sky, we have with us Space Pirate Ben.
Pleasure to be here, Captain Spike.
Welcome, Space Pirate Ben.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to have you. You're here today to talk with us about BioShock Infinite.
Yes, thank you for traveling the 10 feet it took to get here. By which I mean thousands and thousands of miles from the sky.
So, and just to sort of lay out the ground rules here, this is going to be completely just spoilers everywhere. We've already warned the audience a couple times. They've been given a intermission to leave. So feel free to talk about everything that you'd like. In addition, I know that you have a lot of opinions about the other BioShock games. Feel free, if you have any connections to make during this discussion to the other BioShock games, please, by all means, do.
There are just a shit ton of connections. You do, I mean. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, I have not played all the way through BioShock 2, and that's actually a big part of why I feel that
I, it, I think Bioshock 2, is kind of a filler game, so there isn't a lot of direct connections. I mean, it kind of just extends the first story a little more because it's one of those one-off company games.
Yeah.
So it's kind of more of what you are experiencing.
Sure. Game Boogie listener Crystal was just talking to me about that today. Yeah.
It's a fun game, but it doesn't have a strong point to make that takes you into that kind of Bioshock turf like the original or Infinite does.
Now that's actually what I had heard all along from everyone who had played that game, was that as a game it's very strong, just doesn't really have the narrative punch of the other Bioshock games. Is that?
Yeah, definitely. It's got its own point, but its point is, it doesn't really have its own point. It kind of has the first game's point all over again. Seriously, at the end, it kind of reinforces that whole fatherhood thing.
Okay.
Which I'm not saying that Infinite doesn't have its own take on that.
Oh,
but it kind of reinforces the first games again with this whole big sister thing.
That
it plays off is kind of more of just, it's not bad. It's not bad. It was just a secondary company kind of trying to extend a license that was already out there with no information about where the story was going by the primary company, because they were really taking it off the rails.
On the rails. With a hook.
And Slagkick, why don't we briefly go over your experience with the franchise?
Honestly, I played a little bit of the first Bioshock, and this was before I had really become a PC gamer. I mean, I know that Bioshock is available on other consoles, but I had got it during a Steam sale that was super cheap. I'm like, oh, I need to play this because it's apparently super great. I played a little bit of it, and I think just because I had been inexperienced with first-person shooters, I think hit a difficulty curve or something. So honestly, as far as like real immersion in the franchise, this was my first experience, honestly.
Okay, that's a really interesting viewpoint for our discussion. So that's great. And since I probably won't think to come to this point later on, let me ask, are you going to be inclined now to revisit the first Bioshock?
Yeah, I was actually going to say something about that towards the end, but since you brought it up now, this actually definitely encouraged me. I mean, I'm going to have to also appreciate that it's, 5 years old at this point, at least? Years old?
Yes. But, as I've already started my replay on my Steam copy, still a beautiful game. A beautiful game.
I'm excited. I have it on Xbox. I played it on Xbox. It was one of the first 360 games I really got super into.
Oh, yeah.
But I kind of think I might rebuy it on Steam just to have that experience with my nice video card and everything.
I think one of the things with Bioshock is it kind of brought the story-based depth of a PC FPS to the console. It was something rare for console. Console FPSs are more about shoot 'em ups, more of your Halos.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was, it took the System Shock.
Well, I was just going to say System Shock as soon as you were done with this sentence. So perfect.
But it brought that kind of ideal of making a game that wasn't just about blowing things up and shooting people and running around and continuing that, a more in-depth game to the console.
Yeah, and you know,
at least in a popular.
And you know, Captain Spike, I was talking to you a few days ago when I was just like blown away at all of the things that we're going to be going over, like all of the different, you know, things that this game has to say as commentary, and you know, like just the presentation of it. And you were kind of telling me, yeah, like, well, Bioshock, the original Bioshock, did that too. You said, just you know, in a way that games. Like, in a way, more that was more 5 years ago, so that, you know. So yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to experiencing that. And
excellent. Okay. Well, then let's from there take the next step, and I want to ask you both, sort of how you feel, and I guess this applies more to Space Pirate Ben. How do you feel about the evolution of the series? Do you think that Bioshock Infinite was an appropriate direction to take the franchise?
Yes. I think it depends on what their future plans are for it, because it does feel like the reverse of the coin, and almost like it could be kind of ending the whole saga that they had in mind But it would be interesting to see where they could take it if they really do have strong ideas for future games.
Yeah. And I have to say, I hope that they do after that ending.
Oh, yeah. No. You did stick around for the after credits.
Little story, right? Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. Just one more twist if you're to keep your attention. What? Speaking of like the ending, a very kind of definitive yet... what are the next possibilities? We've got DLC coming. We've got season pass.
We have three story packs of DLC.
So what exactly do we know, or are they keeping us hush about this?
We know that there are going to be three. Mm-hmm. We know that they are going to be story-based.
Mm-hmm. We know that, or at least we've heard rumors that one will be about Songbird.
We don't know that, but Ken Levine, who is sort of the overall mastermind of the series, visionary. You could say... has said that in the third one, he would like to explore sort of the history and sort of give us a little bit more information on Songbird.
And so. I'm only assuming that, I can only assume that these are going to be integrated throughout the narrative in the way that Mass Effect 3's DLC, and I guess Mass Effect 2 and lots of other DLC, but I guess that means that I'm going to have to do at least three more game playthroughs, so...
Well, you know, like we talked about last week when we discussed Deus Ex having this issue, just very briefly when we were talking about the Wii release of Deus Ex having the DLC sort of integrated into the game's storyline. I do think for story DLC that it works best when it's integrated into the storyline, but I don't see them making you access it that way in the case of Bioshock Infinite.
Oh, interesting. So it would just be like an extra chapter you could select? Or
I am expecting it to be. And I feel I didn't utilize this option, but I feel like there was an option to go to specific points in the game on the menu. Was there not, or am I misremembering?
Yeah, there was a chapter selection.
Yeah, there was chapter select.
Yeah.
So I would have to expect that they'll add it in that way, and maybe if the DLC does take place during a specific chapter, it will just appear on the chapter select in the appropriate place.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how they...
yes, precisely.
It'll be very interesting to see what they do with that.
Yeah, okay. Slidekick, and this is a question primarily for you. How did you feel that this game compared to other first-person shooters that you've played?
Well, honestly, my experience... is kind of limited to a little bit of Borderlands and then, like Team Fortress, which is not even trying to be like a story-based game at all. I mean, unless you have some really good medic fanfic
or
something.
They have provided a story, a background story for it, but the game is just all multiplayer. It's not a active story game. There's nothing specific going on with why these guys or what these guys are trying to do after they blow each other.
You mean Sandvich isn't going to save the world?
So my experience with first person shooters is very limited. I mean, honestly, like I said, Borderlands, and then a little bit of maybe like occasional Halo or Team Fortress or whatever. But otherwise, like Mass Effect 3 wasn't even first person, but I mean it was a shooter, so. As far as that goes, it's still a genre that I haven't really gotten too immersed in. But, I had a great time with it. I'm still, for me, I'm still kind of learning, the awareness of my surroundings from that viewpoint is something as a gamer that I haven't really developed since I haven't played a lot of these types of games. But, I think it's compelling, and it's interesting because I was reading a couple articles about how they thought, it being a first-person shooter weakened the game because of the strong and, amazing story that was being told. But, I didn't feel that way at all.
I will say that I do not think the game was lessened for being a first-person shooter.
Well, I think that the first-person shooter market gets a lot of its replayability through the online multiplayer.
Yeah.
And because it's a story-based game, that's not a push for them at all. Which is always nice to see good sales numbers on a game like this that isn't going to just be, hey, you're going to spend 7 billion hours shooting other people.
Right.
And cursing at them because you think they'll never find you.
I have to say...
It is worth mentioning, and I apologize, but just an important interjection, that up until fairly recently, there was going to be a multiplayer component to Bioshock Infinite.
There was one in Bioshock 2.
And I was that was back actually the point that I wanted to make is that usually I don't like the idea of tacked on multiplayer, especially when it's done by a different studio.
Agreed.
But I feel bad for Crystal Dynamics when people say, "Oh, the you know the Tomb Raider multiplayer is kind of janky," because like you know Crystal Dynamics wasn't involved in that. And for the product to be brought down, but I have to say, doing multiplayer where you could go on the like rails and shoot that
Sky Rails,
I would have been definitely here for that. But
yeah, I would play it. I would play it. I'd like to bucking bronco somebody.
Yeah,
that sounds like a sex thing.
You've never bucking broncoed anyone? No,
surprisingly not.
That said, I thought it was an interesting presentation because. Kind of to contrast what people were saying that like oh it was not the appropriate type of game for the story being told. I don't agree. I think I would love to see more first person shooters explore like to be more story driven like this.
I think in some ways because it's a first person shooter it does help you take on the role of Booker. Because you're seeing through his eyes and it's not over his shoulder. It's not I'm watching him go through the story. You are experiencing the story as if you are Booker.
I'm happy that you said that, you specifically, because my next question, since I had just given one to Slagkick, was to ask you for sort of how you felt about the game as a first-person shooter, because I know that you have a lot of experience in this genre.
I suppose I do.
Certainly more than either of us.
At this point, probably. Not back in the day when we were, well, I don't know, I did play a lot of Doom when I was a kid. I definitely feel, but I again, the first Bioshock, definitely you feel that too, that you're, it kind of helps you immerse yourself into this person. Also, the idea of not knowing what the hell's going on at first, in both cases, again, you get dropped into a lighthouse, and kind of into this
and
other world.
And there's a girl and a man.
Yeah, but it's this other world that you get dropped into that, like, why sorry, why am I here? What the hell is going on? And what is this place? Why is it here, even? I think it helps you see through the character's eyes and kind of be that person, take on the role a little more than looking over their shoulder.
You know, I absolutely agree. And
that's interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was actually going to move the conversation forward to our next part because I have a segue based
one
on
more
that.
Thing. Plus, of course. Plus, it provides some really good shocks when you turn around that third person's always have a problem with because you can kind of see your back.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it's really good at, oh, you've activated something? Okay, good. Turn around now. Ah! You know.
Yeah. Which I think is important because I was going to say that I probably still would have enjoyed it if it was a third-person shooter. But I don't think – like I definitely wasn't disappointed that it wasn't.
Well, you know, this is perfect. This actually works to my segue perfectly.
Yeah, interesting.
Because I wanted to talk about the art of Bioshock Infinite. And
the beautiful art?
I feel like the moment you come out of your baptism into Columbia, I feel like the shock and awe of seeing Columbia for the first time,
like the Wizard of Oz,
could not have been achieved in any other perspective than first person.
Yeah, I agree.
The second baptism of Booker DeWitt.
Well,
yes.
Well, the first non-avoided baptism.
Well, the
first baptism
of Booker DeWitt, not Comstock.
Booker DeWitt.
Spoilers.
Yes,
you were already warned. So
yeah.
If you didn't
sorry
run,
about it.
It's your own problem.
You're right. It's a very Wizard of Oz moment.
Oh yeah, especially because you still have a shining city at that point in the game.
Yes.
So there's a lot of light, a lot of gleaming touches on all the surroundings.
I'm glad that you said shiny city because I thought it was amazing the way as the story progresses, just how it goes from being this like seeming utopia and like just really like. Grand into this just dark and dismal place.
As you learn about how ugly this place is, it physically becomes ugly.
And I thought that was brilliant.
Get beneath the surface. And again,
yeah.
I mean, the contrast to how the last game started, you get to the city and it's dark where you start with very flickering lights and you don't know what the hell's going on. This one, it seems inviting and open. It pulls you into these people that, I mean, all seem a little crazy, but seem to, like, come, join us, be a part of this.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you phrase it that way, because I was thinking myself, from a visual design perspective, that the first BioShock goes from initially feeling very creepy until towards the end you feel like, oh, my character no longer feels like as threatened by all of these design decisions. The environments are lighter. You're more able to do more things in them.
Well, I think there's a few changes midway in that game. When you finally become a person, mm-hmm. great. Now I'm worried about spoiling an older game. when you break free of all that,
yes.
And you kind of become a man on a mission, his own mission that he's chosen. And because of the choices you've made in that game, you're either kind of an evil dick, or you're there trying to save what little you can.
I eat babies.
Or you're trying to save them. You're trying to the last hope for any goodness to come out of Rapture. You know.
Whereas from a design perspective, and I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm going to finish that thought because you may have something to say about it. As you're in Columbia, it goes in the opposite direction, where it starts very happy, and toward the end it's very oppressive, and I felt very menaced towards the end. I really felt like the game, it started off as this very free, frolic, beautiful, exploring every crack to look at its wonder, and then towards the end it was like, I am rushing forward because I do not want to be here. This is awful.
I completely agree. I mean, you're given this open city, all these shops you're wandering around in. Stealing silver eagles, and I mean, not stealing silver eagles, borrowing.
I felt
them.
Like I was playing Link's Awakening, and everyone should be calling me thief because I was stealing everything.
Yeah, do they not have thieves in Colombia? Because they were leaving money everywhere.
Yeah, seriously.
But yeah, no, it was interesting how welcoming it was at first.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and definitely. I mean, you're like, are we going to the state fair? And you can, like, play the little games. And
yes.
Like that, you know, one of the very first things that, I mean, I assume that all of us saw, but, and probably most people who are listening who have played through the game or who don't care about spoilers, I'm sure most people encountered their barbershop quartet doing the cover of God Only Knows. And I know that we have a lot to say about the music, too, but, I mean, I was just like, wow, I'm like, this is really pleasant. And then, I mean, as soon as shit starts going down, you're like, oh.
Oh, it has a very dark turning point all in that
very,
one moment.
Very, very early
yes,
on.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
I have to say, as far as a design, like, looking at the way the game was designed, it was interesting that, like, it kind of, for someone like me who was new to the game, like, the little carnival games kind of like teach you how to play the game pretty much. So I was like, oh, this is how you use the vigors. Like I thought it was a cute framing device to teach you about, how to, play the game.
I absolutely agree. And, to sort of, I don't know how to quite phrase this properly, but I'm really interested in what you both think. You know, I heard a lot of people who were playing the game initially describe it as, oh, it's like I'm at an amusement park. It's like Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel about
Disneyland.
What I was going to describe as the racist Disneyland sequences?
Or Space Pirate Ben says, just Disneyland.
Well, no, but assuming we all know what I'm talking
that
about
small
here,
world.
How did you feel about the sequences? How did you feel about the sequences where you're revisiting recreations of, for example, the Battle of Wounded Knee? Because while I was awfully offended by the
content,
by the actual content,
yeah.
I was amazed at how astutely, those elements were communicated in the game and how thought out the presentation of these things were within the context of the world.
I definitely agree.
They were very much. The communication was very strong. It's also very rooted in incidental, not accidental, but I mean, it's in the actual t- type of racist art that did exist.
And I mean, I noticed that definitely with some of the posters. Like, I mean, you know, there's a very, very offensive portrayals of Asians and African Americans, which, I mean, as a white man, you know, I certainly can't relate to it the way that a gamer of color might relate to it. But I mean, I was offended by it, but not like, you know, I wasn't offended by the creators. I was offended by Columbia. So I thought that it was, even though, yes, it was difficult. And we'll talk about
that a little more. In the real world, we've done a lot to try to pretend that that didn't exist.
Yes.
So I almost worry for people who don't know about that kind of racism in art and advertising and cartoons and all that stuff.
That's a really good
point. Who would come into this and go, where did this really dark idea come from? Not knowing that it was a very vibrant thing at one point, even if it wasn't intentionally hateful, that underneath it was completely hateful.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that. I spend a lot of time on Tumblr, which is, you know, sort of the land of the social justice warriors. And I actually saw a lot of discussion on that very topic of people really sort of attacking BioShock for appropriating, whether it was appropriate or not, sort of appropriating this style of racially charged propaganda. That's the best way to frame it I can think of.
Right.
And all I could think is, while I appreciate that concern, it doesn't change the fact that, to me, for the time period to feel authentic and for the darker points of this story to be sort of cemented, you kind of needed to accurately represent the kind
of... It wasn't horrifying.
So you're on Tarantino side, not on Spike Lee's.
Yeah, well, not to
not going off topic, but
that's the perfect analogy, though, because you're quite right. I do. I feel that sometimes art has to accurately reflect art in imitating life, or else you have an inauthentic setting where you sort of lose the point. Signal to noise, you know.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it was by no means trying to glorify that.
Well, exactly so. It certainly wasn't saying, gee golly, you should make some anti-Semite posters.
It wasn't trying to glorify it to you. It was trying to glorify it within the setting.
To the Colombians,
Yeah. To show that, again, reflecting the American history in that it was glorified at one point.
Mm-hmm. And yes, that is exactly what I think when I see these posts on Tumblr is, you know, the game is not saying these things are cool. It's saying that this is a real attitude that existed in one point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really important part of, I mean, certainly art appreciation and art history.
There's propaganda art, yes, definitely.
So I was really, really quite amazed at the game's use of those kinds of art materials.
And on a similar note, I totally don't remember what they were called in-game, but the little cinemascopes, I don't know if they had a proper name in-game, but the little viewing machines that you look in and you see the little silent film.
They did, and I only know that because there was an achievement that was counting them as I was getting them, but I don't remember what they were called.
No, was it the Visiscopes?
Something like that.
Something like that. Remembered it.
I mean, because the recordings were called voxophones.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you make your points about the scopes?
I love how authentic that was, and I mean, you know, to further develop I also liked when you learned a new vigor or upgraded the vigor, how there was the little visual of that. That was cute.
Matching the old BioShock again, which had like the
did it?
Oh, it had like training animations that looked like Fallout did in their games.
Where
go through those kind of because it again reflecting kind of the same era that Fallout was.
Mm-hmm.
It does that same kind of animation from like the 60s, like the school films.
Oh, so that's exciting.
No, they do a lot of work to properly represent the aspects in that sense and make sure that they've copied everything they need to copy and to make it feel authentic.
They were called kinetoscopes.
Kinetoscopes. Okay.
And you were making a point, I think. Did you?
No. Oh. I was good.
And I have to say, you know, we kind of talked about how the world got darker and grittier. But I mean, I guess we kind of talked about it, but I mean, I thought that was really visually contained well, like with the color palette.
Violent, like really bloodier. Yeah. With the, once the Vox stuff kicks in,
oh, yeah, definitely.
The reds really kick out. The shadows kick up. Flickering lights from fires a lot.
Well, I started to have a really menacing response. Like, I felt almost like under attack by the game because it was so harsh.
You feel the walls closing in. It's,
yeah.
It's serious. It's nice when a game brings you in that deep. Yeah.
I really briefly like to talk about the character design because, I mean, one of the biggest comparisons that everyone's been making is that Elizabeth is very much like Belle from Beauty and the Beast, Disney. She's a very Disney heroine.
First, I'm very happy that you brought that up because I was going to move on to character designs next. It's literally on my list of show notes. So, delightful. But Belle, I hadn't heard that, although certainly as really? You see it, I can, as you say
there was
it,
a Penny
I can
Arcade
see it.
Comic about it.
There was.
They were joking goodness. That the game didn't end with Songbird and Belle dancing.
Yes, it was great.
They would have been disappointed, yes.
But I also thought that I was describing it again to Game Buoy super fan Crystal. We were talking about it, that it almost just kind of... I wouldn't say that they really like used strong cell shading in the way that like Borderlands does, but there was just something very much about kind of like the, I guess, almost like the wash, you could say.
Well,
that was very, or like, you know, it looked very.
Well, with Elizabeth or Anna. Sorry, just throwing out that spoiler because we've already declared
course.
This a spoiler.
Yes,
zone,
yes.
Or a spoiler maxed zone. no, well, I mean, that's to show her descent into the real world. She very much starts off as an idealized princess in the tower, and she comes off, but watch her costuming as the game goes on. Her clothes become torn.
She becomes
very shocked by everything going around her. Yeah, and until she becomes her own person and cuts her hair and gets that.
Yes.
There's that interesting reflection into her destiny with that costume of her mother's that she puts on. She gets a shock of the real world after she gets out of her gleaming tower, which is literally a gleaming tower. And her dream of going to Paris just goes flying out the window as she has to deal with everything going on. And
it
not
is
convince you,
in
but
her convi- design.
Oh yeah, no, very much. I'm so. Sorry, not I... convince you, but convince Booker that doing the right thing is more important than whatever giving him some moral and ethic. Direction.
Come on, Dad, do the right thing. speaking of Booker, I'm curious. I mean, you know, obviously as a first person shooter,
are you moving onto Booker because I had one.
Oh,
more
you have
point
something to say about Anna slash Elizabeth.
You've reviewed the art of BioShock Infinite art book.
Yes.
Oh, it's a really good book.
I suspect, of course, that you are familiar with the original reveal trailer for BioShock Infinite, as we discussed it on air.
I'm glad you interrupted me.
Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up to both of you in this context is because you might probably are aware of how radically the character design.
Yeah, I think Joystick or somebody ran a story about
Anna slash Elizabeth changed over the last couple of years since the announcement of the game. Now, I don't want to go too much into detail, but I do want to know ultimately whether you think the changes they made ultimately were effective.
Definitely.
In terms of visually communicating sort of the way that this character feels about the character of Booker, who is, of course, the player surrogate in the story and setting, as well as communicating sort of, and I guess you answered this to some degree, where she's at on her personal journey.
I definitely think that it was a big improvement. I just feel like compared to the original Elizabeth's designs, she seems a lot more expressive. Like just the way she's presented, it's a lot stronger. There's a lot more emotional portrayal coming from her. Like the previous views and the original concept we had seen for her just kind of didn't really grab you the same way. Like, and I don't know if that's just a combination of like refining the art, refining the animation, So, I mean, her animation was very fluid. It was like some Disney level animation.
They did a really good job because when she is happy and bright eyed early in the game, you feel like that joy. You feel that joy, but when she is sad later on, it hurts a little. It touches you, and you feel bad for this person for having kind of ruined her life for the second time.
I learned it by watching you, Dad.
They did a beautiful job with the character. With really finding a way to make her her expressions just sink in.
Yes.
Now, Slykick, you were saying about Booker.
Now, of course, as a first-person shooter, we rarely see him, but I think there's one time that you see him in a mirror. I was reading something about mirrors and that there aren't really any in the game. I think there's one time you see him in the mirror, and then, of course, at the end, with all the different lighthouses, you can see Booker walking around.
Mm-hmm. You can.
And so I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. I mean, as far as, like, a very basic character design, I'm like, ooh, he's fine. He's like, what, 38? He's looking good for 38. But, I mean, I'm curious more about as a first-person shooter to actually have those brief moments where you do see him as a character.
I think Booker looks good for 38 because the alternate version of him looks terrible for 38.
Yeah.
Not to get too deep into what we might be talking about later, but I think it's odd that Comstock feels like he's at least 20 years older than Booker.
Well, it was intentional, one assumes, to sort of hide the reveal. Well, but also, there is an in-canon explanation given over the voxophones.
Kind of.
That exposure to the Terror Machine, the proper name of which escapes me.
The Siphon.
The Siphon, yes. Had given him cancers and rendered him sterile. And I guess I had assumed it was also responsible for his premature aging.
See, early on, I knew there was going to be a twist for him, but I had thought early on that the idea was that when I kind of put together that he might be an alternate version of Booker, that maybe, especially when they started introducing time travel as even a possibility, that maybe he was from the future, which is why he'd come off as a prophet. But they don't seem to address something like that. Yeah, they do try to go, it's more of the damaging side effects of
right.
all the equipment.
Well, the damaging side effects of trying to play God, in a way.
Yeah.
So one thing BioShock is trying to teach you, stop fucking playing God, damn it.
Yeah, human manipulation, not a great idea.
But yeah, I'm just
alien
curious.
Alien manipulation, on the other hand, brilliant idea, just saying.
Is that what you do in space? I see.
A little.
I'm curious just as far as the moments where you do see Booker, does that ruin the immersion at all for either of you?
I don't think so, but I think that's why they're so few and far between. I do need to take a brief moment to say I don't personally have a strong opinion on the fact that the game's box art and
that whole controversy.
Advertisement campaign represents the game as sort of typical, like a
dude bro
Uncharted style romp. But that is certainly an aspect in which the art of BioShock has come under fire, and I'm curious what both of your opinions are on that.
I mean, I was always on the side, on their side, you know, even though, yes, we talked about in, was it Last of Us that, like, insisted that the female character was on the box art?
Yep.
So, I mean, I respect Naughty Dog for, you know, being very vigilant about that. But, you know, and I kind of want to, I don't want to get too much into it because I feel like our next part of the discussion is going to be touching on a lot of feminist issues, but, you know, it didn't bother me.
I don't think any of the advertising or the box art affects the game itself.
I agree with
that
you.
That was kind of the point that they were making from the company.
I mean, I also understand, but it is supposed to reflect the game that you're going to buy. But I think most of the people who are really into it to play the kind of game BioShock is were there already, and they were kind of trying to tap a market that were looking for just another brain-dead shooter.
I definitely think that that's true, and I certainly agree with you. I feel like we may have discussed this topic on the show quite some number of weeks ago, but would literally been 10 episodes ago.
Yeah, it was a news item.
But I just wanted to sort of touch base with your guys' opinions. There's one more aspect of the art of BioShock Infinite that I really want to touch on, and that is I want to ask you guys how you felt about the contextualized use of licensed music.
Loved it. Loved the reinterpretations, and also loved the in-story explanation for it.
I agree. It was really interesting at first. At first, I was kind of caught off guard. I was like, wait, that song wasn't around back then.
You know, the first one that I really noticed was a interpretation of Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
Aside from God Only Knows.
Yeah, well, that I understood, but I just was like, okay, well, they're fibbing that one a little bit because the song is so appropriate for the setting. Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm. It was Girls Just Want to Have Fun that was like, wait a minute.
Hold on.
Now, that was supposed to be, like, Fink's brother or something in universe. It was Fink's brother who heard the music through the tears and then plagiarized them and sold them. Which
yes, no. That is one of the...
Yeah,
and now, that you pick up.
That Vox phone or whatever, it really, I was just like, wow, that is a really great way to hit and that now, angle.
Do you remember the one tear where they heard, like guitar rock? That was that, like, the actual version of Fortunate Son? I think that's
of
what it was.
Creedence Clearwater, yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, the context where it's presented later.
That really actually had an emotional effect on me. I thought it was really brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
I must have just stood around and listened to that for probably longer than he did.
Yeah.
Like, there were a few moments like that in the game. Where I don't normally have this moment in games, but I literally just stopped to appreciate how much thought and effort went into pretty much every aspect of the artistic, the visual art, the sound design, just every aspect of this game was put together to communicate feelings and have an impact on the player.
No, I remember the delays that this game has suffered, and I wanted to be angry, but... having played the original BioShock, just part of me knew that what I was in store for was worth it. And I will get mad at a lot of games for delays, even small ones sometimes. But knowing what I was going to get and anything they needed to make sure that the experience I felt was at least as strong, if not stronger, than the original BioShock, I was in. Just tell me when you want my money.
You know, it's like Shigeru Miyamoto-san said when people were complaining about the delays of Zelda for Nintendo 64, Ocarina of Time, which is now widely regarded as one of the best games of all time. Personal opinions notwithstanding, I certainly don't think that, but I respect that it's a popular opinion. Yeah, right? It's not even the best Zelda game. But, you know, he had said quite famously that nobody really remembers the delays. They remember the quality of the game.
Yes.
And a game that's been rushed to market will often be a failure. A game that is delayed to be perfect will be perfect.
I'm kind of seeing the difference between a Mass Effect 3 and a BioShock Infinite.
I think there is a balance to that still. I think there is a certain amount. There is a certain number you're going to lose out on.
Yeah,
if you delay for too long.
I was paraphrasing, by the by.
But of course, yeah, you're trying to balance. I mean, it's art, especially in this case. Yeah. And art is never perfect to the artist, from personal experience. No matter how brilliant it might be, and no matter how much other people tell you it is great, you only see the flaws and the things you could have done better. And it was a brilliant game, but I'm not the artist. And so I'm not kicking myself for the little things.
Well, and it's so pleasing to me that you phrased that as you did, because the next topic or subtopic within this discussion that we're getting to is literally entitled BioShock Infinite as Art.
Woohoo! So, a seg!
Clearly, sort of as is the norm for the series, BioShock has, a lot to say about a lot of things. So I really kind of want to discuss the successes, and failures of some of these themes, motifs, and commentaries that the game is sort of attempting to operate with. And, you know, sort of talk about the effectiveness to varying degrees about these things as, you know, read from the perspectives that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So let me start by asking you, Slaggig. I keep making motioning.
He is pointing, so I know who he's talking to. Slaggig knows who he's talking to. He knows who he's talking to. But you might be a little confused.
let me... How do you feel about the way the game communicated with you regarding religion? And further, what did you feel it was trying to say?
Well, I mean, I thought the thing that was so fascinating, looking at it in the context of evaluating everything after the that final, not the final scene, but the, you know, the finale of the game. And I just have to say, I didn't, even though, you know, the, I made the connections between Rosalind and Robert Lutes. I don't know if I'm saying it right.
Lutes, I think it was.
Lutes. I did not see the Booker DeWitt, Zachary Comstock connection at all. Like, that just hit me in the face. But, I mean, I think the thing that is so fascinating for me is that, you know, the whole game is presented as, you know, Columbia is this, like, religious stronghold, you know, Comstock is a prophet, and, you know, Elizabeth, a.k.a. Anna, is kind of like the Messiah. You know, she's like the, she's the heir to the prophet's, you know, so she's kind of like the blessed child or whatever. But the thing is that
The Lamb of Columbia.
Yes. But the thing is that ironically, I mean, you look at the type of person Comstock is, and in the context of the game, Booker DeWitt, who at least the Booker that we're playing, who didn't become Comstock, he rejected baptism. So in a way, rejecting, you know, organized religion, he ultimately is the one who is more moral than the version of himself who accepted religion. And in the context of the game, religion and, you know, the word of God and all of that is being used as an excuse to act in morally irreprehensible ways.
I think either Booker is kind of immoral, actually. I think it's through the game and through Anna that you kind of gain some morality by the end of it. But, I mean, he was there thinking he's on a job. That's how he justified the mission. I mean, he sold out his own daughter to pay out a debt. He was highly immoral. He was a very dark character who was just there to do a job as far as he was concerned. That's how he justified it in his brain after being jumped to this other reality and trying to put everything together. It was, I'm here for a job to solve a problem. He didn't pull it back to, I'm here to save someone and do good. And he was so focused the entire time that in the game of finishing the job, trying to go to New York, trying to finish the job that he was obsessed over.
When New York was really ultimately not even ever going to be a thing.
Well, no. New York is the flash to that future that they were both getting.
That's true.
Horrors of Columbia finally trying to destroy America.
You know, it's funny because I hadn't really considered the angle of how Booker's subconscious was justifying his presence in Columbia. And that is a stated sort of mechanism that occurs within the game. Robert Lutes, in fact, very specifically tells you that that's what Booker has done.
Yeah.
Your brain kind of fills in the gaps, even if it's a lie.
And I hadn't really considered what it means to Booker as a character that his subconscious...
I don't mean to interrupt. But yes, the first moral choice he really makes is to kill himself.
Yes, although one could make the argument, and I certainly hope I'm not sticking to my guns too strongly here, but one could make the argument that the Booker that rejected religion is ultimately the one to make a moral choice.
No, definitely. He is the one to make a moral choice, but he does this because he's a father, and he has to accept being a father. The other one wants to be a father. He didn't. His wife died. He was ready to reject fatherhood, and in accepting it, he was able to make the one moral choice, and it caused
I think it's interesting is that Booker finds redemption not through religion, but through, you know, through just owning up for what he did to Anna, and, you know, like you said, and I think, well, it's also interesting to contrast.
Well, he finds redemption through fatherhood. Again, another another thing of the BioShock run, the first game, at the end of it, if you haven't killed the little sisters, you've done that as the game goes through. You've accepted that's what you want. You wanted a family. I mean, because the game starts with this picture. You think you have a family. You don't really have a family. When you take on a mission, your mission is to save the one hope. Again, unless you're a dick, mm-hmm. and to accept fatherhood, because that's what you want.
Interesting.
You want a family, so you bring all these little sisters out into the real world so they can be people, and you can be a father, and you can have your family. That's, and they do that in BioShock 2. Just so that is a run of the game, is this idea of fatherhood and roles you choose.
I hadn't really thought about that as a theme with respect to BioShock Infinite, but as you're saying it, it's very clear to me that it's one of the more major themes, just maybe not one that I'm personally particularly sensitive to. But certainly there's a lot of contrasting to Booker's actions as an actual father and Comstock's aspirations to be a father, and what this means to both of them insofar as how they feel a father should be treating a child.
You know, I don't want
to... With Booker ultimately wanting to sacrifice himself for the sake of his daughter, and Comstock ultimately doing everything he can to deprive his daughter and even torture her to turn her into what he wants her to be.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to backpedal or anything, but I thought it was really interesting contrast. When you first go into Columbia, you have to be baptized. Comparing that to Elizabeth, I'm sorry, Anna at that point, she's Anna, drowning you, which is not a baptism. And then, I mean, also you think of Comstock, Booker killing Comstock by drowning him. So, I mean, I think there's just an interesting, that whole theme of baptism kind of, and the contrast of
I did have one more question regarding religion.
And rebirth.
Oh, absolutely.
Again, in the first game, kill Ryan.
And rebirth through the glory of your children, in fact. It's very literally done.
They have some very strong angles they are playing.
Absolutely. With regard to religion, I did want to ask you both. I felt that there was a very strong sort of subtextual statement, I should say, being made and explored regarding Comstock's evolution to sort of the monster, you might say, by not accepting the responsibility of the awful things he had done because he felt he was no longer obligated to acknowledge them after being reborn via baptism.
I think it's worse than that. He does. Remember, he's got the statue of himself as the hero of Wounded Knee.
Now, see...
He takes them in as, like, his pride, his justification is that he has been baptized, and he is therefore righteous and right.
Well, and see, the way that played to me was that he as a character viewed these as essential steps to get him into the baptism and then achieve ultimately what he achieved, to himself, in Columbia. Whereas Booker DeWitt, ran from life after that point and had to learn just to keep breathing and get through the day with these things on his conscience, which he explicitly did say to Anna when she made her first kill and asked her how when does it get better, and he was just kind of, it doesn't. You just have to learn to live with it.
Yeah.
Whereas I didn't feel that Comstock had any realization about living with it, and through religion came to celebrate that, oh, this led me here.
Oh, yeah, no, he justified his actions.
Yeah, and I mean...
It's playing on the idea of blind religion.
Yeah, and I mean, like, and I just have to say right here, you know, that we by no means are trying to, you know, offend anyone who is of a religious nature, but, I mean, let's be real, there are people who are religious extremists, And, you know, like people, for me as a gay man, who people were saying, oh, homosexuality is a sin because the Bible says so. I mean, that's, I think,
totally doesn't
Well, in reflection to the original game, the original game is about blind greed. This game is about a blind religion and blind faith.
Blind faith, yeah.
And
that is definitely
a is the third game. Is the third? Well, I mean, this is the third game technically, but
the second,
the next game going to be about blind melon. Sorry,
that's the sound of a joke failing.
Wow, you went really, really far for that one.
See, you fit right in here on the SS Game Buoy.
I'm about to have to walk the plank here, I'm afraid.
Well, I want to ask you, Sidekick, I know that you had said that you had a point that you wanted to make, sort of regarding the presentation of battle of man versus self in a literal way.
I thought it was very interesting that when you get that reveal, I mean, it sounds like Space Pirate Ben kind of had started putting that together sooner than I did.
I definitely thought, I think the turning point for me was actually around the time of Wounded Knee, the Disneyland ugly,
okay,
awful
wow, that's pretty early on.
Knee.
So you kind of
the idea that Slate goes, he wasn't even there.
Yeah, I started to think like, except maybe he was.
that
was the turning point, like where I thought there's something going on here regarding identity.
I kind of when I play a game this in depth, I kind of play all the angles in my head. So there were moments where I felt really sure, and there were moments where I was like, I don't know. And but no, it was there was definitely a lot there, especially once it's revealed that you can reflect upon and go, oh, look at the path of
clues. I mean, it's literally presenting to you as by having Booker, you know, eventually trying to stop Comstock. You know, that's not his original goal, but that, I mean, by the end, that's what he sets out to do, is to stop Comstock because of this terrible world that he's created. You know, it's really representative of the choices that Booker, before the baptism, there were two directions he could have gone. He could have rejected it, and he could have embraced it. And I mean, there's really, like, you know, obviously because Comstock becomes Comstock, these were things going on inside of Booker's head, you know, like that he was dealing with, whether, you know, he chose to follow those thoughts one way or another. So, I mean, it's literally, you know, when you think of most games as most games that you think of, you know, as like a literal, like a good guy, bad guy. But, I mean, this is literally an internal battle represented as, you know, that sort of trope as the hero and the villain.
Well,
I think one of the
reasons he does kill Comstock the way he does is he's put his own villainy onto that part of him, we'll say.
Well, and in that case, it is absolutely a very literal interpretation of man versus self, as Slykick has said. But let me ask you, would you kindly share with me your opinion, Space Pirate Ben, on how you felt about the game removing control from you in the sequence where Booker does kill Comstock?
No. Sorry, just doing a would you kindly joke.
Well, that was I specifically framed it to draw that parallel.
Well, yeah. I think it's Booker trying to take control over his own actions again. So he takes them away from you as the player. And he's letting out, again, his hatred out of himself for what he's done, even if he doesn't fully remember it at this point.
Yes.
Out on Comstock, on this alternate version of himself. Because immediately afterwards, you've got Elizabeth, your nose is bleeding.
And can we point out that there's another death by drowning here?
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, which I briefly brought up.
He bashes his head into the baptismal sink
You know what I thought was really interesting? I'd love to know both of your thoughts about this, is that...
Just can't trust the water.
It almost seemed
like... You didn't
like,
learn from Rapture, damn it. Don't trust the water.
It almost seemed like Comstock was expecting, waiting for Booker to kill him. He almost seemed to willingly... I was expecting a big shootout with Comstock, and it was very...
I wasn't, and here's why. We're dealing with a character who was aware, we're told rather explicitly, of sort of f- future events. If not in necessity, then he understands what is likely to happen and how to achieve those ends, which is, of course, stated in Rosalind... how did we decide that? Lutess's Fox.
I saw someone
Fox phones.
I saw someone on YouTube comment about the lettuces. I was like, no, that's not right.
She very explicitly states that Comstock has access to the rifts, and he doesn't necessarily realize that he's only viewing possibilities, but that he does see these windows, and so I assume he knew that Booker was coming, and that he wanted to frame to Anna via communicating to her, "Oh, watch the false shepherd kill me. He's awful." As a last-ditch effort to sort of sow distrust between Booker and Anna.
Well, I think Anna's hope in that part of the game is kind of reliant on Booker. The journey they've gone through, the darkness she's seen, him having any kind of light inside of him is kind of all she's got to hold on to reach something other than still just becoming the Lamb of Columbia.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, she several times does indicate that she really wishes she had an option other than trusting Booker. The one that really comes to mind, of course, is sort of being reunited with her after nearly falling off that airship Zeppelin thing.
Yeah, no. She doesn't like the idea of it, but they're stuck. They are intertwined again.
To answer your question more directly, I do think that Comstock knew Booker was coming, and
I think he knew he was coming.
I think that he attempted to not fight in order to make his death happen in the context that he thought could achieve his goal.
Yeah, no, his assumption was that Booker's own selfish evil nature would come through, and it would, once she knew what he had done, screwed, but he didn't take into account that he was genuinely remorseful at this point.
Yeah, and again, because he saw, presumably, a possibility that maybe if he... One could extrapolate, that maybe he saw a potential timeline where that gambit did work, and she was dissuaded into leaving Booker's side. But in this timeline that we're controlling, and Booker has started to become his own man and sort of have real, genuine regret and morals, in this timeline, she stuck with him after that.
And I guess, you know, Comstock kind of actually addresses that now that I think about it, that, like, you know, this was the false shepherd's plan all along, you know, and he tried to kind of, like, try
Ask
to manipulate
him about
her.
Your finger.
Yes, yes. Ask him about your finger.
And still, you know, so it's interesting to think of, I mean, it's obvious that, yes, he saw Booker coming, period, because, I mean, that's, you know, that's how he was able to, you know, set up the false prophet, you know, deal. But also that maybe he wanted to be killed in this way in order to, like you said, you know, Elizabeth would be like, "What did you do? You really are the false prophet. I can't trust you."
Well, yeah, I think that was the goal that Comstock was working towards, and I think probably that gambit worked in some timelines.
I guess he didn't expect for Elizabeth to have Anna to have a mind of her own and be a boss bitch.
Well, martyrdom has a very, very strong effect. Look at the idea, the Vox Populi with the alternate Booker.
Oh, absolutely.
That they promoted as him, that he was the martyr for their cause, and they were able to kind of fight back and push into destroying Columbia.
More useful to them dead than he ever was alive, I think is stated rather explicitly.
Exactly, because they promote him as a martyr, not as a mercenary who was there still trying to finish his
job.
So
ultimately, when you think about it, lots of Bookers die. Booker the martyr dies. Booker dies, but then at the end, did he really die?
Booker the lesser. Booker.
And then really Comstock, who is Booker, dies.
And, you know, further, a really popular theory online is that every time you die, you know, you have to you reset back to the office and you have
bring
to...
Bring us the girl and wipe away the debt.
And then you have to, you know, press the button to open the door, and then that's where you respawn. A lot of people online think that this is representative of another timeline's Booker coming into play at that point in the story.
Oh.
And
yeah, that's a really good way to frame it.
And I think that that is almost certainly what's being communicated there. And I hadn't thought of it for myself because I hadn't really even considered that as a thing.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of that happening. But now it seems very obvious to me. And of course, game itself does clearly communicate, you know, that Booker has done, they've already gone through 17 plus Bookers, you know, because they ask him every time, you know, heads or tails, and he always gives them an answer. And of course, you know, on the boat, they know that he doesn't row because presumably in all across all of these timelines, they've asked him.
Oh,
so
no, they bring it up, the inevitability of everything, because that's why they're playing all these games of choice and chance, the caller, because as far as they're concerned, it's almost like they're stuck in a loop, but they also don't see another way out of it.
Presumably, they will, if they continue, find a break in the loop.
Yes.
But obviously, they also have to initiate said break. So, I've heard, and this is sort of branching off from my point, from our discussion a little bit, so I'm going to keep this brief, but I've heard the suggestion made that this game is in many ways as much about the Ludus's search for redemption as it is about anything else. How do you feel about that interpretation of this story?
I think, yeah, they've looked at what their technology, what their dream has been turned into, and they don't like it. They don't like what's coming of it. They were interested in science. And
science? It's interesting that in the way that, Comstock was trying to play God, in the way, like, they were trying to kind of defy natural order of things by messing with time.
So you're telling me that the person playing God cast down his right-hand man, and ultimately his right-hand man, whom was cast down into the depths, rose up to stop the man playing God's plan.
The Antichrist, the false shepherd. And yes. There are a lot of deep...
Goodness.
More than anything else, I think you can find a lot of faux depth in things that don't have any. But a game that really does have this much depth, you can just tumble down the rabbit hole into forever examining and breaking it apart.
Well, you know, that is literally exactly why we're discussing it in depth here today, because we don't normally give this level of attention to any old game.
No, I listen to your podcast. And, the radio waves do reach into space. I don't know how you guys get them on radio waves, because it's an internet thing. But
You're such a jerk.
We do get them in space, and and no, they're you guys are taking a moment out to go in depth into a game, and you guys generally just reviews and quick tidbits, but it's freaking BioShock.
Well, yeah.
So rarely do games come along with this much depth to really break down and to kind of get everyone's personal views. Again, the whole religion thing kind of hits you hard at some point, no matter what your personal views are, the kind of twist that they've taken on it, and knowing that we live in a world with a billion different twists on the same religion, and different extremes that people can take it to, and to see a game that is going, well, these people took it to this extreme, and you're stuck in the middle of their insanity.
Well, with that having been said, we've talked about some parts of this game as art that I think we would all probably agree the game was very successful in communicating. I want to talk now a little bit about a level on which this game was clearly communicating in some way, but sort of the success of that communication has been called into question. That is to say, I'd really like to know both of your opinions on how the game handled and what it had to say about sort of, let's just say, race issues.
Mm-hmm. I think we almost kind of touched on this with the propaganda that, you know, Space Pirate Ben was saying that, you know, a lot of times it's easy to ignore that ugly part of our past. And I think that was really, I mean, for some people it might have been uncomfortable that it was thrust upon them. But I mean, I think it's important. That's why a lot of, that's a one big reason about studying history and, you know, looking at our past is to not make the same mistakes. And so, I mean, I think that, yes, sometimes it might have been difficult. It didn't upset me too much. I mean, like, I was shocked for sure when, you know, the interracial couple, like, was like, okay, you won the lottery. You get to kill him. And it's like, you know, that was a shock. But, I mean, I wasn't, like, so offended that I had to turn the game off. I understand some people... I was reading, like, on Tumblr, Land of the Social Justice Warriors. Like, some people were like, I had to turn the game off after that point because it was so offensive to me. I didn't find it...
Well, they missed out.
Yeah, I didn't find it offensive in that way. Like I said kind of earlier with the propaganda, I was offended by the Colombians, but I never once thought that, you know...
No, I'm going to admit that the disgust I felt was aimed towards the Colombians... And then I aimed towards the Colombians and started firing. The disgust for the things going on totally fueled my running, me in my running around and killing these people, even if it wasn't Booker's reason for running around and killing these people. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure every last one of these sick fuckers was dead.
Racist garbage. That was really, I had to that opening scene in particular. Now... I don't know that the game necessarily said anything particularly unique or original about racism, about the effects of racism, how one could combat these things or how things could have been handled better. But having said that, I did think that the game used them in such a way that I had very strong feelings. Yeah. Again, in particular after the opening sequence with the interracial couple and winning the lottery and being expected to do this ghastly thing, which
you were given an option to shoot them, right?
I couldn't.
No, I couldn't either. But I
tried to throw him a rock at the guy.
Yeah,
and then, of course, stop.
Yeah,
but I mean, there was one of the options was throw it at them or throw it at the.
You know, what's kind of messed up is I'm sure everyone here chose to throw it at the guy. That if you did throw it at them, if there was some other thing that happened.
That's what I'm curious about.
Well, I want to know, but I don't want to see it. Like, I just, intellectually speaking, I want to know what the developers had in mind for someone
I'm sure
who
there
does
was some
that.
Sort of intervention.
I'm pretty sure the same thing happens, because that's kind of the play of the game, is your choices don't matter.
Yeah, well...
Yeah, is, again, kind of the opposite of the original.
You know, it's interesting...
Well, it's like I couldn't kill a little sister in the first game.
Me neither.
The idea of it disgusted me to the core.
Despite knowing that there are some gameplay rewards, not to go into any specifics because we have people here who have not played that game, but
like, hell no.
There are gameplay rewards for eating small children, but I still couldn't bring myself to do it.
In space, we do not eat small children.
Oh, good. I'm happy to hear
only
that.
Only large ones. Sorry.
But yeah, I definitely thought that the way the game used a very, what I thought was realistic portrayal of white supremacy viewpoints circa earlier, you know.
Kind of turn of the 20th century.
Yes. I really did feel like they used it in a way that really fueled me to have, like, actual, as a person, not just displeasure, but, like, actually, like, I was actually angry at these fake people.
Yeah.
I couldn't bear it. I wanted to mm-hmm. stop these people.
The player has an anger, but Booker doesn't.
Yes, which is, of course, an
interesting
juxtaposition.
I thought
Booker is kind of blind to that. He doesn't care. It's
I
not
kind
part
of
his goal.
I guess I might have been inserting myself into Booker. Yes, please. But, you know, I kind of felt like my Booker, like, and I guess the thing is that, you know, choices ultimately was just an illusion in the game. But, like, I chose to not fire at the guy who stabbed me in the hand, which doesn't have anything to do with racism, really. But, you know, like, I kind of thought that my Booker did. But, I mean, I guess it really was just me and not Booker. So that's interesting. But
Got you a little deep, didn't it?
What I thought was interesting is that I kind of expected more about the racial topics than actually the whole game covered. But I understand it had a lot of things to say, but I kind of expected it to go a little bit further. But, you know, I mean, not saying that it was a failure in that respect.
I did like that the game, to me certainly, clearly illustrated the idea that, you know, the violence and the oppression toward the minorities of Colombia ultimately begat the violence of the Vox Populi lashing back at them once they had
and
the means
I'm glad
to.
You brought up the Vox, because...
The racism in the idea of games as art, the tone they took, the depth of which it affects the game world, I mean, it was definitely art, you know?
It was interesting to me that, you know, when you first are introduced to the Vox Populi, you know, you kind of, Daisy Fitzroy, you're kind of like, I don't know if I can trust her, but, you know, you kind of feel like she's on your side, but then you end up, Elizabeth ends up killing one version of Fitzroy, and then, I mean, at the end, the big final battle is the Vox Populi. You have to kill them, which is kind of, I don't know what to make of that, really, because, I mean, the Vox wasn't just African Americans. It was also, I believe, like the Irish Americans. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there was another.
There are the Chinese, the
right,
the gun maker.
So I mean, for this game to go from, and you know, and the one Booker who was the martyr, like, you know, directly influenced the Vox Populi in that timeline, and that's where it starts to get tricky: is which version of the Vox at the end? Is it the one?
Well,
in the same.
But again, he was martyred. He was still on his mission. They just used his death to fuel. What's the idea you're kind of stuck with?
Right, but what I'm interested in is it that timeline Vox Populi that you were fighting off at the end? I think it gets kind of hard to tell. And I guess the bigger question is, does it matter which Vox Populi you're fighting at the end?
Well, I really, and I don't mean to be cruel or rude, but I do think that the answer to that is that ultimately it doesn't matter.
But what is
not it? Only because the ultimate end of that the game worked towards would negate the Vox Populi having even existed in this context to begin with, but because simply by virtue of how many timelines you've hopped by the time you've gotten there, their identity relative to your Booker, it no longer, to me, really has any bearing or context or weight anyway.
And for that reason, does it mean that the fact that you're having to fight them off, even though they are racial minorities, does not make that final battle racially charged?
Well, you know, I think that is a really interesting question.
I mean, because arguably trying to defend yourself, right?
And I thought it was very interesting that the minorities in this game were painted in a very sympathetic light up until the point where they weren't, at which case Daisy Fitzroy was really portrayed as an extremely bloodthirsty and, I would say, maniacal figure.
At one point it felt like they were kind of twisting it, but I think it had to do with portrayal, the in-game portrayal versus the reality even in-game,
yeah,
that you kind of want to see her as this rebel leader trying to free people as opposed to, like, just somebody out for blood.
Yeah, and my reconciliation for this is, of course, that sort of the violence mindset ultimately begets a violent mindset, that this chain of events has led to a violent uprising, and unfortunately across several
times. I mean, you have to think of Daisy's backstory. She was accused of killing Lady Comstock.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was more curious about how to reconcile that ending, and I guess you just have to realize that, you know, I was unsure how I felt about it, if there was a racially charged, like, kind of turning, you know, you're kind of at first sympathetic to that and to the Vox Populi, like you said. So
I don't think for Booker there is in any of that. Again, even at that point, he's kind of trying to reach a goal and they're trying to kill him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just like at that point, everyone else is. Everyone is trying to kill you and you're just trying to get past.
So I guess I really have to ask, do you feel like the game was sort of effective in utilizing sort of these big racial issues, questions, and feelings sort of in achieving its goal. Like, certainly it gave me strong feelings, but at the same time, you know, like I sort of complained a moment ago, I don't necessarily feel like it did anything new or original. I didn't come away from it feeling like, I guess the best way to do this is to compare. I came away from the game with a lot of strong opinions, and I felt like I had really had insight to sort of religious fanaticism in a little bit of a different way than I had previously. I did not feel like there was a big point being made regarding the racial issue, racism bad, and of course violence begets violence, but that's true even without the racial.
You know, kind of to establish the environment of the
game world. The racial tiff kind of falls under the justification through his fanatical devotion.
Exactly. It does go hand in hand. And like I said, you know, I felt like they could have done more, but, you know, I don't think that means that it was a failure. I just had expected a little bit more from that.
Well, and that's kind of what I mean.
I expected that to be a bigger part of the conversation than it ultimately ended up being.
No, I can definitely see that. Again, that kind of the oddity of feeling like they almost turn her character on the head. Although, again, I think they were playing with the perception you have before meeting her and the truth of her.
Yeah, I absolutely think that that's true.
I think everything kind of serves to the goal, and as in a lot of ways, the game is trying to make a kind of equal but opposite statement of the original BioShock. Not even necessarily completely opposite, but again, it's about corruption and blind fanatical devotion to something or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so. Anything they say at the end has to relate to that. And yeah, I guess in a way. It did kind of, in this game, cut off some of the possibilities of where they could have taken the story, but they had their own closed loop with that.
I'm kind of curious if the DLC is going to explore some of these topics of race more.
I've seen a lot of people online call for a DLC chapter that would explore the timeline of sort of the Vox Populi martyr Booker.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be interested in seeing that.
Yeah, I would too.
And I think we have one real big sort of art angle left to explore. And I think that you had strong feelings about this in particular, Sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel about Elizabeth's role in fitting sort of the identified known trope as a damsel in distress?
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is that I had recently watched Anita Sarkeesian's first episode of Women vs. Tropes in Video Games, which talked about the damsel role. And so, you know, I kind of at first was thinking, you know, even though I loved Elizabeth as a character, I loved the game, I was like, as someone who feels passionately about, you know, the feminist cause in gaming, that's been very prevalent discussion in the industry these days, I was kind of like, you know, I kind of wish, and this was early on, I kind of wish that this game did more to break out the trope of that trope. Because literally, like we said, she is a damsel locked up in a tower, and you are sent there to save her. Now, what I thought was really fascinating is, by the end of the game, ultimately, I felt that instead of, at the beginning of the game, it feels like you're Booker and you are leading Elizabeth with you. Mm-hmm. Like, you're leading her along. She's there to help you out. But ultimately, by the end of the game, it's really subverted the trope. She is leading you along to carry out what only she can do.
She knows the path at that point.
And I think that's really represented in when the future Elizabeth gives the instructions to past Elizabeth, and that only she will know how to unlock the puzzle. I mean, Elizabeth is the one who restores order. She.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's true that Booker willingly lets himself be killed, but I mean,
even when you're leading, you don't know what the hell you're doing or where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
And it's once you've reached that point, yeah, Elizabeth takes command, but she knows the path at that point. She knows what's going on, and she's trying to get you to the point so you understand.
And, I mean, you think about all of the powers that she has, you know, that you think if you didn't – like, I have to think about what really struck me is, I mean, well, first of all, you know, the tears, like, which helps solve some of the puzzles to move forward in the game. But, you know, I think what really struck me is the time that you're separated. She's not there throwing you health kits. She's not there throwing you ammo. And it's like, even though you originally think of her
– frankly, I felt a little bit lonely, but continue.
No, you are stranded.
You're stranded, yeah. And I had come to rely on her. I had depended on her. And whereas you think, oh, you know, she was just there to help out, but, you know, there was a real need. I was lost without her. I was like, I have no ammo. I had to run away. I had to run away from the enemies.
I needed my buddy. My buddy was gone. Booker had his own reason for going after that. But me, again, my passion was my ally, my one friend in this world against me is gone. God damn you, Booker. Shut the fuck up. Get your ally back.
Yeah, and I mean,
you cannot handle the world alone, which again is part of, I think, the point of it.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree.
And I think it's really interesting to see that a heroine does not necessarily need to be, oh, I am Princess Zelda wielding a sword in the Link role. I mean, and I think I was talking when I first beat the game, I was talking to Captain Spike about this, that I kind of thought about Zelda's role in Ocarina of Time. I thought it was similar, but not as powerful as Elizabeth's role. Because the thing about Zelda's role is it's still ultimately pretty limited. And then the thing is that as soon as Zelda reveals that Sheik is actually her, oh, she's captured within, like, I think Anita Sarkeesian said it was literally within 3 minutes. She is trapped in that, you know, diamond or whatever it was, and, like, you have to save her, and she's back to being the damsel again.
I think one of the interesting things is the idea of going and getting Elizabeth kind of falls under that, the annoying, much-hated...
Escort
mission, yes.
Yes. Yeah.
And it is not at all.
No, not at all.
She is more useful than you are 90% of the time. And yep. She's necessary. She's, I don't want to put it down to like a tool or anything, but I mean, she's another perspective and part of the game that needs to be there for you to feel whole as the character.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that that's an accurate read, and I think that it's an absolutely correct pardon to point out that sort of the game does certainly go out of its way to empower Elizabeth and very, mm-hmm. very specifically break from right. the expected.
You know,
it is trolling the player. In
well, oh, ways, absolutely.
Which I love because
it's Kojima in it.
I love to screw with people, and I love a game that takes the time to screw with
you. Now, yeah. I have to ask you on a similar note, kind of with a different trope, something that kind of made me a little uncomfortable is when, when I realized that Elizabeth was Anna, my daughter, I felt like the game had been kind of trying to play up a, like, romantic angle between Elizabeth and Booker. I might just be me, and so I'm curious. But, I mean, after that, I was left with, like, a very Oedipal kind of, like, feeling.
I think as a player, you can view it that way. I don't think that they ever... I think they very specifically, right. in the way they're giving it, is letting you take it that way if you want to. Again,
right, so it's interesting that...
But not actually playing it that way.
As Booker, yeah.
Again, they're playing
so it's, the father angle. It is very fascinating how...
But they're also playing, and again, this ties into the strict feminism view. Sorry. They play into sort of the explicit expectation of us as gamers. Oh, we expect her to be powerless. We expect her
to be a love interest.
And ultimately, she is none of these things. And I guess I was guilty
of that. And I think that maybe for those of us. So it's interesting. It's really interesting to think of not only these themes, but also that these playing with these tropes, not only like within the context of the story, but like the both of you were saying that, like, what the player expectation is and kind of being, like, it's a very, like, meta commentary on what we expect as gamers.
Oh, yeah.
Or what we tend to be presented. So I thought it was really, it kind of forced me to look at and be like, well, what was it that made me want to think that they were love interests or whatever, so.
Even within the limits of kind of keeping the story parallel to the original, they found a way to play the players, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Well, okay, from here, and I think we're on the right topic for this. So, you know, that was a really interesting take on sort of how they dealt with anticipated sort of reader response. So I want to get away from sort of the explicit parts of the game, and I want to sort of ask you a couple of questions to wrap this discussion up, just about how you responded to the game, how you felt about the game. And, you know, I just want to kind of want to go in a little bit more of a cheesy way, because I want to talk about some cool stuff about the game and sort of close on sort of a strong note. So do either of you have, like, a favorite moment in the game? And I'm going to start with Slagkick, because Space Pirate Ben got this look on his face like, oh, shit, where to start?
A favorite moment? Damn you.
I think one of my favorite moments was, and we were actually talking about this before recording, Captain Spike actually missed out on this. It was a little Easter egg, I guess. There's one part in Shantytown when you're in Finkton and you're trying to you kind of solve this whole mystery about Chun-Li. I almost say Chun-Li. The mystery of Chun-Li.
Yeah,
the mystery of Chun-Li, and you go into this. I think was it a bar? I think
yes,
it was a bar.
It was
and
the
you
basement
go,
or the bar.
You go into the basement and there's a guitar there and you can pick it up. And it's just.
And I did that. I went into the basement and everything.
You
I
never saw the guitar?
I just didn't even notice it, no.
I think if you get close enough to it, there's a verbal cue from her.
Oh, okay.
So you might not have passed close enough. You may have just looked at it, seen nothing over there, and walked away.
Yeah. Well, you pick it up.
No coins to steal. I'm out.
Booker starts playing the guitar.
I don't see a boxophone. I don't see coins or ammo. Yeah. Forget the guitar.
Booker starts playing the guitar, and Elizabeth's still at that point. Well, but she's also Anna, but...
Continue.
She starts singing along. I just thought it was a really tender moment, and especially once you realize that that was like a father-daughter moment. I mean, it was short, but it was really tender. And I mean, I think it was a significant enough moment that if you watch the credits long enough, which I know both of you did because you saw that last scene, they show the recording session of the the voice actor and the voice actress.
Yeah, see, so I watched this clip.
And you're like, oh, what are they doing?
I watched this clip that Slykick is talking about just before we recorded this when they realized that I hadn't seen it. And I was like, I know this song. I feel like I've even heard this recording. Like, but I definitely didn't do this content in the game. It's because they show the live recording at the end. Yeah. I was like, that song didn't appear in this.
Well, I mean, didn't they also have, like, in a, like, more choir version when you first come into Columbia?
There is, that song is in the game.
But just
recording.
That recording. Okay,
well,
yeah.
Again, playing on the circle, the loop. This thing they're trying to break.
Will the circle be unbroken? Just brilliant. Well, a brilliant little moment.
Will give you a headache.
In the good way. Yeah, you know, it's very much that circle, the loop that the Lutesses, the Lettuces, are looking to break. That having been said, have you thought of a favorite moment for me?
I there are a lot, and I could probably go into detail, but I will say I did have a moment of jump for joy when you
I knew you were going to say that.
Going back up in the bathosphere that you took down in the original game. Just that moment of being like, oh my god. Oh my god. Oh. I mean, there are a lot of great moments in this game, but again,
just as someone who is such a big fan of the original.
Yeah. But outside of that, there are a lot of moments of contemplation and moments where I, as the player character, wanted the reach out and hug Elizabeth button when she's just in these dark places and he's still remaining cold and distant, and you're just like, she needs a hug, damn it. she needs someone to care about her, you stupid bastard. Reach out.
And this is so interesting. Now that I had not, before we had this discussion today, I had not realized that Booker still kind of, I think I'm putting more of myself as the player, into.
It's really easy to. It really, really is.
Because I definitely felt a very strong connection to Elizabeth.
No, I was sitting there. I was mad at him for not making the effort, just because he was so focused and he still wasn't putting things together in his own mind.
Do you think that was intentional, or do you think that was kind of an oversight on the developer's part?
That was definitely intentional.
Okay.
Oh, I definitely agree that it was intentional on their part. And just for the sake of everybody getting a go, I'm going to unbiased
answer.
No,
we can skip it. We can skip that. It's your question. You don't get to answer it.
My favorite part in the game, if I had to pick one moment.
Don't hate me. Hate space.
My favorite moment was probably looking up at what is presumably the stars on the light at leaving the lighthouse.
Oh my goodness.
And just for having the enormity of the concept sort of busted out in front of you, and just
all, like, those of aren't these stars, they're doors.
All of these BioShock Infinite possibilities.
That was a very visually
games
compelling.
That can touch me that deep and make me feel something are so rare, and have my love and devotion because of that. Be they simple Game Boy Zelda games that made me cry at the Ballad of the Windfish as everything disappears.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or something as beautifully constructed and high concept as this.
I mean, I think it's a testament to the richness of this game that we've been able to talk for almost 2 hours about it. I mean, not just like... I think we had spent almost an equal amount of time just talking about the Mega Man series, but this is one game. So, I mean, just the passion that it evoked in us. I have a quick question, and I hope that I'm not stepping on your toes here. It's kind of a more superficial question. But I had been talking again with Game Buoy superfan Crystal about this. Do you have a favorite Vigor?
You know, it's funny because the next question I was going to ask was, what was your favorite Vigor?
Are you serious?
And then, do you have any awesome Vigor combinations?
Okay, I've talked to Captain Spike about this before, but I did have, and it seems that everyone has a different reaction, because I've had people that felt more connected to the Vigors in this game, but I felt a little more connected to the plasmids, and sometimes I forgot I had Vigors in this game, and I go through entire battles shooting people, even though you have less weapons in this game than you did in the last one. Or not the last one, but the original.
That's interesting, because it wasn't until about maybe midway through the game that I started utilizing my Vigors more.
No, I think one of the other things about that is that because you had to unlock slots in the original, too. But I also felt that plasmids had been the corruption in many ways of Rapture, this whole genetic splicing, and it kind of you made a good point before when we were talking about this before,
and that was also an opinion that was based on not even quite halfway through the game.
Yeah, that it's kind of before that kind of level of craziness could have kicked in.
Yeah, they're still sort of presented as a new technology that people are, you know, because Columbia is still very new in its way, and during the time that you're going through it, it's all still very pristine and shiny, and only a small...
Shiny, happy people.
Reasonably small window of time has passed.
But I think people, a lot of people have felt more connected, and I felt more like it was almost like, oh, we have to include those because that's part of our game.
Yeah, I don't feel that the Vigors were as organic to the setting as the plasmids were to BioShock, the original one, to Rapture. That's a good, but there was an expectation as a player and as a game that this would have super-powered
Now, for me, having never really played through BioShock 1, I thought it was... I liked it, especially when I started to use them more. you know, I thought that the way of presenting it was clever. And I really like the different when you drink the vigors for the first time, like the different animations for your hand. I thought that was cool. As far as my favorite,
them consuming you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, my favorite vigor was definitely Shock Jockey.
My general combination was Shock Jockey traps to cover my backside, and then to possess usually any machinery that was there to gun against them, or like I honestly it sickened me a little to have somebody blow their own brains out or whatever way they killed themselves. So I take over machinery and
I loved troops.
I used possession a lot, and it actually like revulsed me initially, especially because, you know, any human that you possess with it kills themselves after they're done. And so the gamer part of me looked at it as, oh, anyone I hit with this, like, they're going to effectively be like a turret for me, and then they're going to self-destruct, and they're off the table for me as an enemy as well.
I think that the funny thing for that is, as much as I was disgusted as watching them kill themselves, I had no problem shooting each and every last person I could between the eyes. I was going for headshots. I even had I forget which gear it was that gave you, like, extra damage for headshots, because that's what I was focusing on. Was just to blow their brains out. But them blowing their own brains out felt a little wrong. That's my job, damn it.
To kind of elaborate on my my love of Shock Jockey, from a gameplay standpoint, I unlocked, or not unlocked, I purchased the upgrade where you can chain them, and that really helped me get through, especially the Lady Comstock / Siren sequence, where you're just constantly being bombarded by these dead.
I posted myself up in the because you fight her a few times, but when you're inside the building,
yes.
I posted myself up on one of the sides, had a sniper rifle, mined the stairs so there was just Shock Jockey all over the place to guard my back, and was sniping them and her as best I could, and kept running down to the machine to buy more ammo and health as I needed.
Nice.
Because I was playing on hard, and that was one of the things to me in this game, is I felt that early in the game, there wasn't a challenge on hard, and I felt there was a point where it just kind of flipped, and everyone just had a ton of extra health.
I felt that on normal as well.
I played on normal, and I felt that way as well.
There were certain guys that were clearly more armored, but I also felt there were just the same guys I had killed before almost, and they just weren't taking damage from my melee attack.
Yeah, I felt that way as well. I did. And
that bugged me a little. I don't like hard just meaning more health. But I guess if that happened even on a normal, there was a certain process that they had built in.
Something you just said was the perfect segue to my next question, which is, what was your least favorite moment in Bioshock Infinite? And I'm going to go with Lady Comstock's ghost fights.
From a gameplay purpose?
Was not a fan from a gameplay purpose at all. I appreciated the angle of how Lady Comstock was brought back as a quote-unquote ghost. But, I mean, like, for example, her being reborn from another timeline through her powers, or whatever the pseudoscience answer they gave in game was. Okay, that's cool, but why did she have the power to raise the dead in graveyards and stuff? Like, that's literally, she was raising ghosts.
I had a problem with it because I don't like the regenerating horde, because usually you can get, there's a point where you can just get stuck in a corner. In fact, in that, when you're still in the vault of the bank, you can get stuck where they're kind of closing in on you. You keep regenerating in there, and you're just like, I can't even get to ammo.
I died a lot during that.
So I don't like the regenerating horde for that, because it's just like you need to kill them to get through to a point where you can fight back. And sometimes it's just like, I feel like I'm wasting all my ammo on somebody who isn't the boss. And what happens when I need to really kill this thing, and I'm out of, you know.
Yeah. I think that the resolution to that story part of Anna sort of forgiving and apologizing.
And I thought the whole overall, it was very moody.
I thought that was good, and I did like the tension and suspense.
Just the actual gameplay was kind of frustrating.
But the gameplay, I really felt like the gameplay failed in that sequence. And again, the gimmick of Lady Comstock as a flying wraith banshee thing that, again, is raising the dead. It just didn't work for me.
If they had introduced, I have struggle to say bigger or not plasmid. But they introduced some sort of plasmid that was for the purpose of affecting a ghost, as opposed to just keep shooting it until it dies while all these other things are shooting you.
Yeah.
I think that would have helped that a
yes.
lot.
Or if there had been a plasmid that, for example, temporarily reanimated the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you could even use possession on a corpse and momentarily reanimate it.
Or if the solution wasn't just to keep shooting her until she died, but to use a plasmid that brought her fully into the world or something and made her a person.
That is the single part of the game that I feel, from a gameplay perspective and a narrative perspective, really just failed on every level and could have been done so much better with only slight changes. But what about you guys? Any least favorite moments? Any parts where you felt like the quality dipped just a little?
I think there were a couple places where I was trying to get around on Skyrail, and I wasn't quite sure where to go, so I was just making like loops around, and I felt like usually the game did a pretty good job of visually communicating, and you know, you could hit, like, I was playing on PC, you can hit the N button to be like, okay, here's a hint of where you're supposed to go. But even with that, I was like, the level design at that point was kind of not really visually communicating where I was supposed to go.
Again, with the Lady Comstock thing, you could keep hitting that damn button, and it would keep sending you to the loop rails in the middle instead of wherever she was trying to lead you.
Now that you speak of it, I think that was the exact part.
No, I'm trying to figure out which direction she went, because I followed her up to a point, and then I clearly lost her.
And I was like,
it actually turned out she was way past that, and there weren't tracks through this section, and I kept telling me to go back to the loop. For no reason.
So I think now that you mention it, it was that point, and
absolutely no reason.
Also, like, some of those rails did seem like, what was the point of these exactly? I get that most of them are for transportation of some stuff, but you run into some and you're like, what were these ones doing here, really?
Mm-hmm. Let the record show that Space Pirate Ben was just looking up quizzically in the air as if there might be skyhook lines in this room.
We should install some in the Game Boy Studios.
I'll bring some.
Lovely.
I look forward to it. You were saying?
Oh no, just it's just interesting that we're kind of realizing that it's this whole sequence that's kind of was the weak point. But I think kind of what I had said about
I think there are strong story elements to the beginning and the end of it.
I thought the way it resolved was really well done emotionally. I just think they could have gotten there a little cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Agreed. It was just interesting to me that talking about it, that it's really just this one sequence that we're kind of, and I didn't dislike it. It's just that thinking about, we all had different issues with it. So it was interesting. It was all from the same sequence.
I think another thing in the presentation of that area is when you go through that area before, the places it leads you to eventually were all locked. Yes. And they could have found a slightly more organic way of letting you explore these places and unlock information about her before you got to her.
Yeah.
Instead of going, now you have to hit the three spots to collect the three keys to unlock the final boss battle.
I really disliked that sequence a lot. Like, again, this entire sequence was just not working for me. That was sort of the one part where it's like, oh, follow her tracks.
I was at the Lutessa's shop before that going, I want to get in here. There are answers to this crazy quantum conundrum inside this building. Let me in. No, you can't go in here yet.
I had gotten, you know, that I was supposed to go to a specific area, but once I saw all these doors unlocked, I went and explored the entire rest of the town before I started the next event, which ultimately took me back to these places that I couldn't get to.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I'm 100% with you there. Again, sort of the one, to me, real major failing of the game. It's just sort of that entire sequence.
We all hate Lady Comstock.
Right, and contextualize the dead raising thing. It wouldn't have been hard. A vigor, even just a vigor that they demonstrate use on in like a non-interactive part where like one of the salesmen is talking about, and coming soon, our revival vigor. That's all it would have taken.
Use a fallen enemy to, or tied into possession. I think possession could have been easy.
I really do. I don't think it would have been hard. But without any contextualization to the greater story, it's just like, oh, she's a ghost banshee raising the dead. Cool.
This experimental Vita chamber.
Yeah, well, right.
For use in future undersea developments.
I have three more questions, and I'm going to try to get through these a little quicker because it is time to start winding down.
Yeah.
First off, what did you think about this game's take on alternate timelines in comparison to sort of popular works in fiction in the last year or two, such as Primer, Looper, or Fringe?
I love alternate timelines.
Me too.
Comic book geek, sci-fi geek. So the idea of paradoxical time travel and alternate realities where, you know, you all the coin flips have an alternate outcome. Goldbender. they're interesting, and the game does a really good job of exploring them to an extent that doesn't let you go crazy with them. It's not a game about exploring alternate realities. It's a game about the inevitability of all these realities and this single unbreakable loop again.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, what's interesting to me is that it's exploring alternate timelines without necessarily being a time travel narrative. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, there is time travel at the end. At the very end, if you watch through the credits, you wake up in 1893, is it?
I think it is. That's when
1893, like a week before he originally gives away Anna. And so, I mean, that's the only real bit, and it's because
the loop is closed.
The loop is closed, and it resets to the most plausible.
It puts Booker back in his reality without all the alterations having happened to it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's interesting to me in exploring the theme of timelines without, because I know you said the past year or two, but I, of course, the first thing I think of with time paradoxes is Back to the Future.
Spoiler, I know it cuts to black when you look into before you can look in the crypt, but I'm going to tell you what was in there. Cthulhu. Just throwing that out there. Just so you know.
Baby Anna Cthulhu.
Space truth.
Space truth. Yeah, so I mean that's kind of what struck me is that you know, like we said that to think of time paradoxes, that kind of like time hopping across timelines contemporaneously, of course. And then there was a little jump to the future when Elizabeth pulls you into New York in 1983.
Well, they have visions of this future, yes. Of this inevitability that they're trying to stop, which is why the Lutesses, in theory, have created this loop in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love when a game presents that kind of stuff, or anything presents that kind of stuff, in a manageable way, an intelligent way, and doesn't leave a lot of huge gaping holes. There's always something you can question about it, and, well, does that mean... But as long as they paid enough attention that you don't sit there going, you guys are idiots, and this wouldn't work at all, even in the rules that you've created.
And I think I think what was impressive for me is that I didn't expect. I mean, I knew there was going to be some sci-fi elements because I'm aware that that's a theme that BioShock explores. Is like, you know, kind of like looking at different sci-fi, like there was arguably, I wouldn't say it was like super cyberpunk, but I mean it was pretty cyberpunk, I guess you could say, right?
You mean Infinite?
Yeah.
It was kind of steampunk, I think.
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, cyberpunk is like cyborg.
I can go
on
a whole, no, I know.
I can go a whole rant how I don't think punk should be a...
I'm sorry, I totally meant to say steampunk.
Sorry. a suffix?
Yeah, a suffix.
Like, I feel that it was...
I think it's lost. I mean, cyberpunk was definitely looped
into
the punk, actual punk, and we've reached this point with diesel punk and steampunk that they just they use that word without any
there's nothing
context.
Punk about that. I mean, it's awesome.
There's always some story that can work that way, but the actual idea is there anyways.
You know,
the neo-Victorian steampunk is very strong,
but I don't think it's like forced either.
No, in the same way the 60s pulp future pulp sci-fi is in Rapture.
So I was interested to see, because I'm not super familiar with steampunk as a as an aesthetic, as a genre, but my understanding is that steampunk tends to focus more on like the machinery and the science behind that, and not so much about like, you know, like the timelines narrative. So I thought it was interesting to bring that element into a steampunk setting. And
I think that this is the right question to wrap this up on. I have one last one. Oh.
Sorry. I was just going to say they do an interesting and a very good job of trying to kind of take the idea of Victorian science and the ether and their limited knowledge, if you know anything about that, of things and where they stopped and thought the world they were done, and going, we're inserting quantum science into this.
Yes.
In some aspect. And this is the universe that no one believes can even exist at this point because they thought they were done.
And
here's somebody who's a visionary enough to come in and throw out quantum science and take them like so many steps beyond what anyone else would understand and create this kind of steampunk neo-Victorian world.
And I think that, like, what you kind of... clarified for me is what I was thinking of is that it's subverting the steampunk tropes in a way.
Yeah, it's jumping into
and that's why I said maybe was that's why I've seen it was maybe not purely.
I definitely think it played
a purely steampunk
anticipated reader response.
Yeah,
in a very good way. No, it keeps you on your toes, keeps you thinking. And
I'm sorry, when they explain the what makes the cities float. You know, hot air, it's quantum science.
Because
they love that. They give you these airship-looking things and then go, that's not why they fly. It's not because they're airships at all.
No, it's because the Lutesses found a way to make shit float.
Yeah, they jumped ahead in science and they're playing around with quantum mechanics and Higgs bosons and crazy shit that no one at this time period would have any idea. That's the jump to make this. Not weird magic science that you know, that
it's powered by crystals. Yeah. It's a Final Fantasy game.
All right.
It's just a jump ahead that shouldn't be there.
I anticipate we have about 3 more minutes in this podcast, so I'm going to fire off this last question, and then we're going to go into our thank yous and goodbyes. And that is, if you had to pick, what would you like to see the DLC for this game be about? Because... this question is actually supplanting the question I was originally going to ask, which was, what would you have liked to have seen more of in the game? But we know that we're going to see more of the game. Right. So what do you hope to see there?
3 minutes each, or...
Oh, God, no.
Let's cram in a giant question here at the end.
Okay. Try to be concise.
I have to say, I think I would like to see the Booker as Martyr Vox Populi. I don't know how they present it, but I have to say I kind of agree with the general consensus out there that would be an interesting thing to look at.
A joking rumor was Booker through Rapture.
I would play the shit.
I don't think that was that much of a joke, just as much as it's probably not likely. But
yeah, I don't think they would really do that. Wow. I'm going to leave it up to them on this one. I'm going to take the easy way out of this question.
Well, actually, my real answer was going to be Booker in Rapture. I don't even care. Like, I would love to see Booker take on a Big Daddy. I would love to see...
Ooh, I'd like to see Booker take on a Big Daddy, too.
Oh, girl. I would love to see, like, Big Daddy's taking down a Songbird and just... Not just Booker in Rapture, but, like, a straight-on, like, world versus world... I mean, that almost sounds like a BioShock 3.
Yeah, gotta save something for the next
Columbia
BioShock.
Over Rapture.
Yeah, right? But I'd pay the price of admission for that in a heartbeat.
Big Daddy's walking around on Columbia fighting handymen.
And just like the game, I decided to save one more question. All right. What do you think the post-credit scene had to say?
He already said Cthulhu.
I think it was leaving the future up. It was taking you out of the loop.
I think
kind of in that Inception type of thing, like, oh, will the top fall? Is she there? Boom. Has he learned from this? And is he in a reality where he can use this, the knowledge of just not the knowledge of what happened, the knowledge of being a good person
and
being
father.
A father.
Yes. I think that Anna is behind the door. I mean, it seems very likely.
I felt like it was just a confirmation for people who maybe felt a little bit crestfallen that they had essentially destroyed this character from existing. I feel like it was just important for them to touch that this character still exists in some timeline.
Except, you know what's interesting, just to kind of wrap this up, is that the whole point of the game is to undo everything that happens in the game so that the world can be better. Yep. You go through the whole game trying to undo everything that happens in the game.
And, you know, with that, I think it's time to say goodbye. I think it's time for everyone who is listening to this to give us some feedback. We really want to hear everything you have to say about BioShock Infinite via Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Google+, email, and of course via our home base at GameBuoy.org. Of course, we here at GameBuoy would like you to listen to our podcasting friends over at Koopa Club, Orange Lounge Radio, and us personally at Reading is Fundamental, all about Logo's highest rated drag queen competition reality show.
RuPaul's Drag Race, gentlemen, start your engines. We'd like to thank some great podcasts out there. I'd like to highlight Game Bar. That's GAYME Bar. Like, I want to take you to a game bar. They're the podcast that fills your brain space with hours of gay video game commentary. I've gotten to know the guys over there lately. Really cool guys. As always, Nerdgasm Network. Lots of fun. Best Little Horde House in Azeroth, Girls Gone WoW, both great World of Warcraft podcasts, Video Game Outsiders. I just have to do a shout-out. Probably by the time you listen to this, OLR will have celebrated their 500th episode. So congratulations to Orange Lounge Radio.
And, you know, as ever and always, we have our entire existence as a podcast to them to thank.
Yes.
I would like to make a very, very special thank you to Space Pirate Ben for being
Thank
our
you,
guest
Space
here
Pirate Ben.
And illuminating several aspects of this franchise that I hadn't really
yes.
previously considered.
No problem, man.
Is there anyone you'd like to shout out to? Anyone that you think our listeners should be paying attention to?
Cthulhu, again?
Just
putting that
so go,
out there.
Go check out a H.P. Lovecraft, some volumes.
I'm thankful to have been a part of this discussion. So thank you.
Group hug. And we'd just like to thank, we had a lot of great feedback about Tinglecast. We'll get to that next time because we've really outstayed our welcome today. So
yeah,
thank you for the warm reception to that really fun April Fool's joke we did. Thank you.
Zelda deorchestrated.
Is that like breaking it down into deconstructed? Okay, we're going off the sky rails here. Thank you to Zelda Reorchestrated as ever and always for our theme music. We love it.
That
Go
having
support them today.
Been said, if you haven't played BioShock, you haven't finished. You just didn't care about spoilers, so you're still listening. Get to it. Great game, really incredible. Thank you for listening to us go on and on and on. Keep thinking, keep gaming, and see you, Space Pirate.
I hated this game. I'm going to be honest right now.
We're just going to have a really...
Why do I have to read the script this entire time? That's what I'm wondering, really.
Okay.
Stop. I'm already in the zone.
Okay. Dog. Get in the zone. Auto zone. I love jingles. What can I say?
I do too, though. Jingles and tingles, bro.
I saw right near where the restaurant was, there was an O'Reilly's. I was like, O'Reilly's! Auto parts.
Sorry. Spike and Sidekicks, Tingles and Jingles, a podcast about tingle and jingles.
Ah! Cha-cha-cha, Charmin.
I wanted to be all of mad, but I couldn't.
Ah!
Loti, loti, loti.